joint committee of the Veterans Administration Committee meeting will come to order. The clerk will take the roll call, and I think it's on. And I'd like to have somebody from the House look at our minutes from our last meeting on April 4th, look it over, and give me a motion to approve this. Representative Driscoll?
Mr. Chair, I'll move the minutes from the April 4th, 2011 Veterans Services meeting.
Second to that.
Second.
Any additions or corrections? The minutes are approved as read. I'm going to turn this over to Senator Perry for a little bit, and then we're going to get into our agenda for the day.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Welcome everyone to the committee. This is a difficult time for many people in their lives when we get into the holiday, and I, for one, would just like to set the tone, and I don't know if this has ever been done before, but I would like to ask Mr. Chairman if Chaplain Morris might come forth and lead us in a small prayer before we start this meeting. Would you be so kind, Chaplain?
Good morning, Mr. Chair. Good morning, all of our elected officials and leaders, guests. Would you join me for a moment of prayer? Gracious and almighty God, thank you for the freedom that we enjoy today. But we know that that freedom comes at a tremendous price. We lift up before you the bereaved, the grieving, and those in deep pain in our midst, and pray for your comfort, particularly during this holiday season. We lift up our elected officials and ask for wisdom and guidance as they wrestle with the tough issues of our day, and particularly the issues that affect our veterans and our members of the military and their families. Be in our presence now to guide, to comfort, to lead, and to give wisdom. We ask this in your most holy name. Amen.
Amen. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Senator Perry. Thank you, Chaplain Morris. Those who have an agenda in front of you, we are going to be dealing with the issue of the suicide rates that have been in the news, not only just recently, but in days gone and years gone past. And we have people from different areas of the military that are going to testify this morning. And because our time will be short, we're going to try and effectively stay about an hour and a half on this issue, and then try to move into the issue of the Minneapolis Veterans Home, as was brought to our attention by the legislative auditor. So the last hour and a half, 11:30 or thereabouts, till 1 o'clock, we're going to be dealing with the Minneapolis Veterans Home. So with that, I would like the testifiers to come forward. And we also have a person come in, that a gentleman who would like to talk to us via Skype. We've been in contact with them. They've contacted us to at least testify. So hopefully our monitors will work. And if not, we do have a telephone here that we can talk to him via that method. So during this first portion of our testify today, we will have someone testify from on the Skype situation. So with that, I'd like to have Major General Rick Nash from the Minnesota National Guard come forward and identify himself for the tape, and please present your comments and remarks. Thank you for coming today.
Mr. Chairman, Chairman Perry, members of the committee, good morning. I'm Major General Rick Nash, N-A-S-H, the Commissioner of the Department of Military Affairs, as well as the Adjutant General for the state of Minnesota. I'm going to apologize, Mr. Chairman, up front with regards to my statement that I'll give you this morning. It may seem lengthy, but I believe it'll set the context for follow-on questions that the committee will have and will possibly generate other questions. But I want to thank you for devoting the time to learn more about the topic of suicide in the Minnesota National Guard. Your attention to this societal problem truly benefits all Minnesotans. Before I begin, and this is directed to everyone in the room this morning, to include those seated as observers, please raise your hand if you know anyone who has died by suicide or have attempted suicide. As you can see, this is an issue that affects many of us. But suicide takes a different toll on a military unit. As warriors, we can accept that some of us will fall in battle at the hands of the enemy. But it's devastating when one of us perishes by taking his or her own life, because it undermines the cohesion and the morale in the entire unit. To those of us who have endured the guilt, the confusion, the grief, and anger that comes after someone you know and loves dies by suicide, I offer my sincere condolences. To the military families that have faced this horrible tragedy, I especially extend my heartfelt, deepest sympathies for your loss. I want to reassure you that your service member is truly missed in our formation. It is my understanding that the objective today is to discuss the suicide rate in the Minnesota National Guard. Numerous national, regional, and local media accounts have highlighted this tragic issue, and most recently a multi-part series in the Minnesota Star Tribune. Let me start with the facts. Since 2007, when the Minnesota National Guard began tracking suicide data, 24 service members have died by suicide. Each circumstance was unique, but I can provide an overview of some of the commonalities we have identified using detailed research and analysis into each case. First, two-thirds of them have never deployed. That's an important detail, because there's a common yet false assumption that most military suicides are the direct result of post-traumatic stress disorder attributed to combat experience. This is simply not true. Further, most were white, most were men, and most were in their 20s. I would like to make you aware that this reflects the predominant demographic in the Minnesota National Guard. After reviewing the details of these service members' circumstances prior to their deaths, we have found that membership in the Minnesota National Guard itself is not a contributing factor for suicide. We have also learned that they were all in the midst of personal struggles involving mental health, relationships, substance abuse, unemployment, financial issues, or legal issues, or in most cases, a combination thereof. So why has the Minnesota National Guard suffered such high number of suicides in comparison to other states? According to the most recent data available from the National Guard Bureau, Minnesota's 24 National Guard suicides since 2007 are followed by Oregon with 16, Indiana, Ohio, and Pennsylvania with 15 each. Indeed, it's a sobering statistic, and certainly a reporting category in which the Minnesota National Guard does not want to be in the lead. I want to take a moment to address the topic of tracking suicide data. First, the Minnesota National Guard's number of 24 suicide deaths since 2007 is completely accurate. And it also includes the personnel who have died by suicide, whether they were in a duty status or not. We have a team devoted to ensuring that this information is tracked, and more importantly, that formal and thorough investigations are conducted to illuminate root causes for which we can determine lessons learned and apply appropriate resources across the force to prevent reoccurrence. By contrast, other like-size organizations do not focus on measurement to the detail of the Minnesota National Guard. What school district, college, business, federal or state government, club or town in Minnesota with 14,000 people can produce on demand a concise list of the names, the circumstances, and likely causes of its population suicides, even when its members may not have been physically on the location at that time? I believe that my organization's dedication to getting accurate facts and analysis is an indication of how much we care about eradicating suicide for those that we can affect. As a military leader, It's always my duty to accurately report to the citizens of Minnesota and to the United States the status of their National Guard, whether it's good or bad news. I believe that because good data on suicide is not always readily available, the Minnesota National Guard has gained undue notoriety without substantiated basis for comparison. The essential fact is that suicide rates have been increasing over the last several years, both in the state of Minnesota and across the country, not just among those who wear a military uniform. Members of the legislature, this is a conversation that should be taking place throughout our state and our country. I refer you to the recent statistics reported by the Minnesota Department of Health, which are provided in your packets, that indicated that the suicide rate in Minnesota has increased over the last several years. According to this Department of Health report, the number of people who die by suicide is five times higher than the number of homicide victims. Furthermore, Minnesota's suicide rate has risen from a low of 8.9 per 100,000 in the year 2000, excuse me, to 11.2 per 100,000 in 2009, the most recent year enclosed in the DOH report. The experts at the Minnesota Department of Health say that suicide can be characterized as a societal issue. Minnesota National Guard citizens, soldiers, and airmen are members of our common Minnesota society. The trends within Minnesota fit the national model, and the incidents of suicide of Minnesota National Guard service members are not unlike those of non-service members. Many of the young and inexperienced people in the Guard, just like the rest of Minnesota's young populace, have not developed the life skills that are necessary to cope with personal and life challenges. Sadly, suicide has become a more acceptable solution than it was when you and I were young adults. But here's the challenge for my leaders. Of the 24 suicide deaths, only two soldiers died of suicide while in active military status. Put another way, 22 of these 24 members took their own lives, and they did so outside of a military setting, away from their units, away from their fellow service members, and away from the military leadership that could look them in the eyes and intervene. That is because the Minnesota National Guard is a part-time force with a full-time mission. On the 2 days per month that this part-time force assembles for training at our 63 locations around Minnesota, I can say with certainty a soldier or airman who is at risk for suicide is actively engaged by his or her battle buddy or wingman, by non-commissioned officers, and by his or her officers and commanders. If there's a problem or an issue in a person's life, our team is trained and ready to link that service member with the assistance or resources he or she needs. But this 1 week in a month network of National Guard support, associations, and camaraderie doesn't formally extend to the remainder of the month. Frankly, there may be no one to hold the soldier or airman accountable to work through a difficult relationships, mental health issue, substance abuse problems, unemployment, financial, or legal issues when the member is not on duty. To fill that gap, we count on families and communities to rise to the occasion when a service member, or any Minnesotan for that matter, is facing a personal issue that may lead them to choose suicide. I do not believe that membership in the Minnesota Guard is a contributing factor for that decision to commit suicide. In fact, my leaders and I have learned from VA studies and through our own experiences and fact-finding that deployment and military experiences build essential personal and family resilient skills. And that, ladies and gentlemen, is what we are squarely focused on, the concept of personal and family resilience. To that end, this past summer I directed a concerted effort across the Minnesota National Guard to enhance and synchronize our resiliency, risk reduction, and suicide prevention efforts. This plan has four major action steps. First, we continue to train and educate our force on fundamentals of personal awareness about suicide. In the past, there was a stigma associated with coming forward and reporting voluntarily that there was a troubling issue in one's personal life. Today, we train our soldiers and airmen that seeking help is a sign of effectively and maturely dealing with problems, a sign of strength, not weakness. We encourage peer-to-peer engagement, and we are teaching our force to be comfortable with the idea that it's okay to report that I'm not okay. Second, using the facts and trends gleaned from our investigations into past suicide cases, we trained and required our leaders to deliberately track at-risk soldiers and airmen in the order to identify and address the root causes that may lead to suicide ideations or tendencies. As with almost every issue in our military, progress on this front comes down to engaged and committed leadership. As a result of this effort, all of those in command and leadership positions, including junior officers and non-commissioned officers closest to the issue, now aggressively encourage those in their charge to seek help if needed, and also set an example by doing so themselves. To ensure a consistent command message, I sent my fellow general officers to deliver the message of resilience to all soldiers in small group settings in order to reinforce to all of them the importance of coming forward if there's a problem with relationship, finances, employments, or other stressors. Finally, we established a program that promulgates resiliency training and trains key leaders in special skills. These soldiers, called Master Resilient Trainers, advise unit commanders in the tactics and action steps that result in less suicide. They also conduct engagement training sessions with unit service members to highlight useful skills to address their life stressors. And I'm pleased to report that there have been some encouraging signs of progress due to our efforts. The messages of personal awareness and self-reporting have resonated. We measure this success by the number of self-reported ideations or interventions throughout our force. By way of comparison, in 2007, only one individual came to the attention of his or her leadership that he or she had suicidal ideations. In 2008, there were 8 ideations or interventions. So far, in 2011, 34 National Guard soldiers have made themselves known to their leaders, and their leaders immediately intervened to ensure that the service member received the help he or she required. I've included in your packet a summary from one of our units that show how such an ideation incident and intervention plays out. The names and locations have been left out for privacy reasons, but I wanted to showcase how we have effectively intervened and prevented suicides from occurring because of our leaders' focus and their engagement. The small group discussions with our general officers have also yielded results. Recently, I received a report about a soldier who, after a session with his unit and one of our general officers, approached his sergeant afterwards and told him that he was convinced that the general was speaking exclusively to him and that he needed help because he had spent the previous evening with a shotgun on his lap contemplating suicide. That soldier sergeant was unable to ensure the soldier immediately received the appropriate treatment. As for our master resilience trainers, of the 57 allocated positions that we have in the state, 30 have been filled and the pipeline is full for assigning and training these important advisors and trainers. Minnesota ranks among the leaders in ensuring our allocated positions are filled, and we expect to have all of them completely staffed and trained by the end of September 2012. I would also like to point out that some of the other supporting programs that expand the success of our efforts beyond the scope of military members. As I mentioned earlier, membership in the Minnesota Guard is not a contributing factor for suicide. Instead, suicide deaths among our service members result from a unique combination of risk factors and life experiences that researchers have identified as contributing to suicide in the general public, including the relationship challenges, their mental health, substance abuse, unemployment, financial or legal issues faced by Minnesotans who are in the Guard. In the area of relationships, our chaplain corps has instituted a relationship-focused program called Strong Bonds. that trains our soldiers and airmen and their spouses or significant others in coping with life stressors. The program is available for both married couples and single service members. Relative to substance abuse, drug and alcohol screenings are executed throughout our force, and we have a full-time chemical dependency counselor on staff to facilitate enrollment in substance abuse assessment and treatment programs for those that need it. Regarding employment concerns, the Interagency Employment Working Group, facilitated by the Minnesota National Guard's Deployment Cycle Support Team, meets bi-weekly with interagency partners from DEED, MNSCU, DVA, the Department of Revenue, and County Veteran Service Officers. This is an example of a helpful resource for those serving in the National Guard to gain civilian employment. The 10 federally funded, embedded, licensed mental health providers we have available are a positive asset for our military commanders. Empowering them to make mental health care referrals available for troops during their weekend military drill assemblies. Another systemic mental health success was the establishment of a federally contracted director of psychological help within the Department of Military Affairs to provide case management support for service members in crisis. A final success story to point out is a great relationship that the Department of Military Affairs, the Department of Veterans Affairs, the Department of Health, and the Minnesota Department of Human Services have. MDH has been invaluable in providing assistance and identifying best practices in prevention and training, as well as sitting on our Resilience Advisory Board. DHS has provided risk assessment training to our chaplains and have connected our chaplains with many local mental health crisis teams. To be clear, today's service members suffering from mental health and physical tolls of war or life stressors, regardless of previous deployment status, now have access to our resources that our society has been available to them. Help is available for those that need it. For my citizen soldiers and airmen who are compensated by the federal government, there are options through TRICARE insurance and the VA to connect with appropriate mental health service providers. Current service members also have the opportunity to utilize the Military OneSource, the hotline that they have if they need assistance with a variety of issues. For our veterans, there are state programs such as Case Management, Outreach, Referral, and Education, known as CORE, that connect them with service providers. So what can the Minnesota State Legislature do to assist in reducing future suicides in the Minnesota National Guard and the state of Minnesota as a whole? First, it's important that the citizens of Minnesota know that suicide is a societal problem and not one unique to the military. For the benefits of all Minnesotans, this is a topic better suited for the Department of Health, and I urge the committee to appropriately fund statewide suicide prevention efforts. You have my personal commitment that I will work with the Health Commissioner, Dr. Ellinger, to ensure the right mix of material, campaigns, and public service announcements are tailored toward the military. Next, it should be clear that the capabilities of the Minnesota National Guard are suited toward the areas of prevention and not treatment. Treatment efforts must be led by and in the communities in which our citizen soldiers and airmen live, and not in the once-a-month military training assembly. As for prevention, the Minnesota National Guard is seeking any assistance, interagency partnership, or tailored prevention efforts that the state can provide in the realm of public health to identify and to assist those at-risk service members who are struggling with the root causes. As I mentioned before, the relationship issues, mental health, substance abuse, unemployment, financial, or legal issues that can lead to suicide. Today's returning combat veterans are highly trained, well-educated, and experienced leaders. They are driven and highly disciplined. Some Americans have unwittingly accepted the idea that our warriors are victims. They are not victims. They are informed, experienced, and well-equipped societal contributors whose value and potential have not yet been fully unleashed. I want to highlight one of the significant stressors that we have found in our recent analysis of those who have died by suicide. Unemployment. In October 2010, we began recording whether service members who died by suicide had jobs prior to their deaths. Since then, we have experienced 8 suicides. Of these 8, only 2 had been employed, and 1 had been a full-time student. The remaining 5, or 63%, had been unemployed when they took their lives. This concerns me. As just last month, I visited the 2,700 Minnesota National Guard citizen soldiers with the 1st Brigade Combat Team stationed in Kuwait. While I was there, along with my senior enlisted advisor, Command Sergeant Major Cindy Colbert, who's with me today, we received data from soldier surveys that indicated that a daunting 28% of that deployed force would be facing unemployment challenges when they returned home in the spring of 2012. That percentage does not include full or part-time students. Other sources report that despite the education and experience levels of our veterans, here in Minnesota, we continue to endure more than 12% of our veteran population unemployed, with the percentage of our Army National Guard citizens unemployed at 16.4%, 18% of the women in the Minnesota National Guard are unemployed. Compare these figures to the 5.9 newly reported unemployment rate within Minnesota. Ladies and gentlemen, these are alarming figures on service members and veteran unemployment that concern me, because it's one of the known risk factors for suicide. Why are we unemployed after all this time serving our country? Our returning veterans are not the next generation of problems. Instead, they are the next generation of our state leaders and solutions to our problems. We currently are working with Commissioner Phillips and several state and federal departments and agencies to ensure that employers know the benefits that a military employee can bring to their organizations, and I urge your continued support of these efforts. I would submit to you that there are troubling but consistent anecdotal and only partially accurate reports of mental ill and suicidal combat veterans. These reports have affected our veterans' ability to gain unemployment or gain employment when they return, and it is important that you take this into account as we proceed on this issue. I look forward to future opportunities to fully frame, address, and solve this problem in partnership together. Thank you again for devoting your time to the societal problem of suicide and its effect on the Minnesota National Guard. For those of you who raised your hands at the beginning of the testimony, indicating that you personally knew someone who died by or attempted suicide, you can relate to what a complex and difficult topic that suicide is. It is equally difficult to manage this issue on a larger scale. As the Adjutant General of Minnesota, my top priority is taking care of those who have borne the burden and paid the price for protecting our communities, our state, and our nation. That includes doing everything possible to prevent military suicides. We have an obligation to save future lives. In conclusion, part of our warrior ethos is that we will never leave a comrade on the battlefield. We in the Minnesota National Guard recognize that there's a battlefield at home as well. If it's not acceptable to leave someone in combat, then it's not acceptable to leave them at home either. I want to assure the citizens of Minnesota that my entire leadership team and I are doing everything in our power to strengthen our force, and we will do everything we can so not to leave another service member to die by suicide. And I take that obligation very seriously. Thank you. This concludes my prepared remarks. And at this time, Mr. Chairman, I look forward to yours and the committee's questions.
Thank you, General Nash. Members, are there any questions for the General at this point? I think he's got a short schedule here today. Representative Detmer.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, General Nash, for bringing this information to us and also for your service. And I think we'd be hard-pressed to find any other employer whether in Minnesota or in the nation, that works with its employees, in this case our men and women in uniform, on this issue and the support that we give them. And we know that this is not to be taken lightly, and that we also know, according to what you just presented to us, that this issue is the numbers of basically reflects our population here in Minnesota, not just the military, but and employment is a big issue, and we understand that. But again, thank you for bringing this information to us.
Thank you. Any other questions from the members? Senator Wieger.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. General Nash, has the Guard or other branches looked at reassessing the recruitment process, the psychological evaluation, and other indicators that are used that might give a better insight as to risk factor?
General Nash.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I can only speak from the Minnesota National Guard standpoint. I cannot speak for the other services. We take the same type of entrance exam as the active duty does on our pre-enlistment questionnaires that we have, and so there's a certain limit of what we're able to ask individuals as they take those exams and tests and qualifications to enlist within the military. But certainly I can tell you this from my point of view, since I assumed the position in November, we look very closely at individuals that desire to assess into the Minnesota Air and the Army National Guard with regards to waivers. As another contributing factor, we look back as much as we can because we have the ability to increase the quality of our force. We have individuals that are wanting to join this professional organization, and they're standing in line. And actually, we had to hold off on recruiting last year because so many young men and women want to join the Guard to be something larger than themselves. And so we're able to increase the quality and the educational level of the entrants coming into the Minnesota National Guard.
Senator Beer?
Well, Mr. Chair, that's good for the quality, the educational level, but more at the mental health factors that might contribute as well, and sometimes that risk analysis might provide an insight. And as you know, suicide is not immune to one's sociological or educational attainment.
Mr. Chair, Senator, I apologize for not addressing your question directly. We follow the current Army regulations and policy in terms of how we can delve into someone's background. It's very difficult to find out what's in someone's head and the psychological information that we're not able to get other than what we can legally ask for as they attempt to assess into our organization. So we cannot put up more restrictive type entrance questions or delve more into a person's background or psychological makeup.
Senator Weaver.
Well, Mr. Chair, General Nash, I'm very appreciative of all the programs for identification and service. I'm looking more proactively entry-wise, and you seem to suggest that you're legally limited, but perhaps there would be a need to be able to know more about the applicant going in just to assess that risk factor. Would that be a fair characterization?
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I couldn't agree with you more. If there's a method to be able to do that legally, we would certainly want to explore that. But I concur with you. If we can know more about the individual that is joining our force, at that time, once they become a member of our force, we obviously can know more about an individual and can then take him to wherever those stressors or her wherever those stressors take us for assistance and resources and help. But again, we're getting an individual assessing in that we don't know a lot about, and we try to as much as we can. But I would concur with your assessment that if we could do more, we certainly are willing to do that.
Senator Perry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. General Nash, can you articulate maybe a little bit? You and I have talked about being so cautious and following, for better words, the money trail in tight budgets. How have you addressed, and I know General Shalitov's here as well, and we've talked, how do you address duplication in moving forward so that we can know for sure that the dollars that are going to programs such as this, and like with Lutheran Social Services that I know General Shalito works with too, how are you addressing this to make sure that we don't have somebody fall through the crack and that we have the available dollars that you've been given to make sure these programs are sustainable?
General Nash.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Perry, great question. I'm glad you brought that up. As you and I have discussed, in a resource-constrained environment, certainly from a federal level, and the programs I discussed are approximately $913,000 worth of federal programs that the Department of the Army has forwarded out to Minnesota and to other states that, in terms of get after the suicidal issues that we have. And so we're fortunate to have that amount of money available to us. As you and I have discussed, Senator Perry, and I've also discussed with Commissioner Shalito and individuals within his department, as we get into times of reduced resources, we're very cautious to maintain the programs and the opportunities that we can then channel the right people to the right resource where the right dollars are. And if we're going to err, it certainly want to err on duplication if we have to, in terms of having two programs and sending an airman or a soldier there. We don't want to have a gap or a seam between a serving member, a returning veteran, or someone in veteran status. So we've spent time with Commissioner Shalito and our team looking at how do we provide the information to our forces, ours that are still in uniform and those that Commissioner Shalito has responsibility for. So we're working from that in an interagency basis, I guess, if you will, to make sure that our dollars are spent in the appropriate area and we channelize them to our federal dollars, and then making sure our state dollars or community dollars or charitable dollars that are out there, because there's a laundry list of resources that are available in the state of Minnesota. And the very most difficult problem that I have is getting individuals to the right resource, because there's so much out there. And you say go to the website, go to beyondyellribbon.org, and there's places you can go to. The Military OneSource. There's applications now going on to Blackberries and iPads and all the other things that our soldiers are used to dealing with that provide a resource, and their downloads, and they can click on that if they or their family member or their employer believe that an individual is at risk. And so it's not for a lack of resources. It's getting the individual at the right time, at the right place, at the critical time of that individual having a suicidal ideation to get the help that's there. And we're flush with that. But again, in times of declining resources, which ones do we have to be able to have there? Because a member who is not deployed in the Minnesota National Guard has not obtained a DD-214, a deployment record, and he's serving for 2 or 3 years just out of high school, you know, he can't go to the VA hospital. It's prevented from doing that until he becomes a veteran status with a DD-214. So where do we channelize him to? Certainly we have the core LSS center, as you spoke to, and there's that opportunity. But there's also the Military One Source. There's also county service officers that have programs. So the challenge is getting the individual in the most need to the right place. And I think the answer to that question would be that we need to continue to communicate and look at the programs out there, who's funding them, and making sure that we can get the money to the right resource at the right time for the right individual who's in the right status.
Senator Perry?
That's good.
Okay. Senator Carlson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. General Nash, I just want to make sure I understood this correctly. Is it correct to the information that you gave us to characterize the subset of the National Guard population and the Minnesota population, that the incidence of suicide is actually lower amongst that subset compared to the entire population? Did I understand that correctly or not?
General Nash.
Mr. Chairman, Senator, I'm not sure if I did and I confused you, I apologize. I think the 18 to 24-year-old white male that we have that makes up the bulk of our force is also, you know, that force that's out there that works for 3M and Honeywell and FedEx and Best Buy. And so, you know, I think we may be an indicator of a societal issue out there. That same core group of people, I believe, have suicidal ideations and committing suicide. But again, I think our reporting system, that those 24 since 2007, is accurate, and we research every one of those and have to report to National Guard Bureau, and they're eventually briefed to the Vice Chief of Staff of the Army. So that's how much transparency we have among our force. I would think that we're seeing, and I guess I would challenge this committee to research with the Department of Health and the county sheriffs in terms of how they track suicides within their county. And I think you'll also see the population that will be representative of that 18 to 25-year-old white male. And I think the data that I provide the committee, I think, is from 2005, the latest statistics from the Department of Health. So I would encourage us to make the effort of maybe bringing that up to some level of currency so we can compare data. But talking with Dr. Brashler at the Department of Health, I think we are just an indicator of what's going on in Minnesota and nationally, Senator.
Senator Carlson?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Again, General Nash, if we looked at the entire number of suicides in the state of Minnesota versus the population, and then took the number of suicides of those individuals that were Guard members, is there a lower incidence of suicide in that group? And I guess, I'm not sure if I'm asking that correctly. Did you get what I'm getting at, Mr. Yep. Chair?
Yes. Mr. Chair, Senator, I can't answer that without having the suicide rate for Minnesota. Because, again, it's 2005, so I cannot take the current data that I presented to the committee, the 24 that we've had since 2007, and lay it over a Minnesota population because it doesn't exist. At least if it does, I would certainly be glad to find out where it is, but I can't compare that. I think it's to getting at your answer.
Okay.
But a recent report last week by the there was an article in the Minnesota Star Tribune that, and it shocked me, that 100 people a day in the United States commit suicide. That's a pretty shocking number. So if you extrapolate that over a year and you compare that with Minnesota, I would think that we'd see some comparable numbers, Senator. Or I would expect we probably are lower with the programs that we put in place in February of this year. And Senator Perry, you and I sat down, we laid this out already in February, what I just described to you in an operation order, and that's how the military does business, to get this out to our force. And you say, well, why is it taking this long? Well, you have to keep in mind, since February, in our terms, is only 18 days ago, because we've only had 18 days with our soldiers and airmen, 2 days out of the month. So everything I've told you, all the efforts we put forward, the progress that we've made, the initiatives that we have, has happened in 18 days. And so from those terms, we've moved fairly rapidly to get after this issue since February of 2011.
Senator Carlson, I think that MDH would probably, Minnesota Department of Health would probably be giving us some statistics on something like that, I would think. But I know that they sit on the resiliency board, too, with military affairs. But Representative O'Driscoll?
I've been promoted or demoted. You called me Senator, Mr. Chair.
I'm sorry. Representative?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. General Nash, thank you so much for being here. I can assure you that from my part of the state where I come from, and you know because we've had you as a guest of mine, we are very committed to beyond the Yellow Ribbon community and Warrior Citizen. And one of the things that we have coming up in the first part of next year is our annual conference where we invite different segments of the community to come in to learn more about veterans' issues, and this is certainly key among them. Last week, I had the opportunity to meet with the Chiefs of Police Association in Stearns County, and I asked them if they would be interested in learning more about veterans-related issues, and that they found that or felt that that would have a positive impact on their ability to be able to connect with veterans and to connect with families, and they, without exception, said yes. So the nature of my question is, does the Guard have some kind of a speakers bureau, some kind of information that could be made available to beyond the Yellow Ribbon communities and beyond the Warrior to Citizen and other military support groups across the state so that we can leverage resources to be able to get some more of that information out to the streets, if you will, to be able to anticipate and possibly head off one more suicide in the state of Minnesota.
General Nash?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Driscoll, certainly we would be more than happy to address that. In terms of Speaker Bureau, I and the rest of our team go out on a continual basis and we talk a variety of issues. One of them is this, one of them is employment, one of them is reintegration. So we would be more than happy to do that, contacting our office. I'll do it personally. if that's the case, because that's how much passion I have for not only the suicide issue and the reduction and getting this under control, but also in the employment issue. So I'd be more than happy to address your group or anyone else's that in from your communities that you represent that deal with Beyond the Yellow Ribbon, returning our veterans in our 63 communities that we have across Minnesota. That is something that we want to do and be proactive in communicating with our citizens who support so well the Minnesota National Guard.
Representative O'Driscoll.
No further questions.
Senator Daley.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, General Nash. Thank you for your close attention to this critical matter and to reporting to us directly yourself. Certainly, we don't even want one more suicide, and it's important we do bring attention to this matter and put the right systems in place to prevent even one more suicide. Your discussion about the impact of unemployment on the suicide rate is a critical part of this conversation. I'm very happy that you brought that up. So we find ourselves in a situation where we have to find a balance between how much and in what manner we talk about this and the public's perception of what's going on. At the same time, employers are so critical, we don't want them to think that these incredibly talented young men and women who have these great skills are not capable, because they are. You and I know how talented these folks are. So if you could just talk briefly about some employment initiatives that you, Colonel Best, maybe Chaplain Morris and others are taking so that we can get the word out to prospective employers how talented these young men and women are. The fact that two-thirds have never deployed, it's not so much a PTSD thing, and we clearly communicate to the public about the talent that's out there.
General Nash?
Mr. Chair, Senator Daley, thank you. Again, going back to Representative Driscoll's request for speaking, I seek out opportunities to meet with employer groups, whether it's the Minnesota Chamber of Commerce. I addressed initially when I came back from Iraq and talked to them about jobs, talked about employment and return on investment. The best return on investment they can have in their business to hit affect the bottom line is to hire a quality returning veteran who has the skill sets. And I also go out and talk to the Rotary Clubs, wherever business people are. I came from 32 years in business, so I can address them. I know their concerns, and I know their anxiety about hiring a service member. I'll just leave it at that, let alone a veteran, and the number of deployments that we've had from the state of Minnesota over the last 10 years in our conflicts that we've had. And so there's a anticipation that they think the guy's going or the lady is going to deploy again, and so they're concerned about that. Then when you add on the stressors that they think that they're damaged goods, if you will, coming back, as I said in my written statement, society tends to buy into the unwitting thing that we're damaged, or we have issues, or PTSD, or we're suicidal, or we have all kinds of other issues, and that's truly not the case. I don't think we know the extent of PTSD. I leave that up to the mental health providers and evaluators in terms of what percentage that is, but certainly the RAND studies that are out there are probably overly inflated as compared to some recent quality studies done by our own Minnesota National Guard here in Minnesota at the Veterans Hospital in Minneapolis, a quality report that's ongoing from the deployment from 2005-2007 that Representative Creusel was involved with. In terms of his rotation, as well as what's going on now with that brigade combat team that's currently serving in Kuwait and returning this spring. That evaluation is that broad, and so I think you'll see less numbers from Minnesotans that will come back with issues. But I seek out Senator Daley, the opportunity to talk to business people about hiring veterans. We have tremendous companies that have signed up for Beyond the Yellow Ribbon. Best Buy was the last one that was proclaimed right before Thanksgiving. And the CEO, Brian Dunn, of Best Buy, told his entire group, over 1,000 people there, that he was going to hire veterans. When he heard the story from a VTC, from Colonel Eric Kurska in Iraq, about his concern about returning veterans with 28% unemployment, he made the comment there in front of the governor that he was going to hire veterans. And so that's the impact we have when we go out and engage companies. But we have great companies that have signed up to Beyond Yellow Ribbon, and we can provide this committee that list, but they are very supportive. And so when you have people of the stature of Best Buy, a national organization, saying they're going to hire veterans, others will follow their lead. And so that's leadership in my estimation when he stood up and said that. And other large companies have done the same, the Target Corporation, for instance. So we think we've made headway by going out and engaging and talking about this issue. And it's all transparent. And we only talk about the facts. We don't talk about other things that are written or in reports. We talk about the facts that we know. And we reassure our employers that we have great men and women who serve in your National Guard.
Any further questions? General Nash, I have one question that I'd like to ask is, what is the military's response to these people here who have admitted to your people that they have thoughts of committing suicide, and the response to the family outside? Just, I mean, you bring in a person, man or woman, they have family outside. What's the response to those individuals if they come to a chaplain or to their team leader or whoever it might be, and they admit this? You, of course, I think, would say they get help. But I've heard too many people saying that the military doesn't care once they've been, because they've fallen through the cracks.
Mr. Chairman, if I could, I would like to have someone that deals with that on a regular basis. Those 34 ideations and those that we've transferred over to another resource. If I could, Colonel Chaplain John Morris, who gave the invocation this morning, is part of my team that deals with this and has set up the Operation Hope Lake that we kicked off in February and has dealt with these issues, both deployed as well as back here in Kona. So if I could, Mr. Chairman, I would like to have Chaplain Morris address that fact that you bring up about the families, because Chaplain Morris deals with those issues.
Chaplain Morris, if you'd identify yourself for the tape and proceed.
Mr. Chair, Chaplain Morris, the State Chaplain for the Minnesota National Guard. Sir, committee, I've been in the military long enough to see an entire cultural change. And so what happens in today's Minnesota National Guard is our first-line leaders are so well-trained now using a program called the Shoulder-to-Shoulder Program, or what we commonly refer to as ACE. This little card, all Army personnel have this, and it has three steps when you suspect somebody is exhibiting all the signs of being suicidal. The Air Force has a similar program called Wingman. The point is, we've trained our soldiers and our airmen to the point where they now bring to us their battle buddy or wingman that they're concerned about, right to the first line leader. First line leader, 90% of the time, then involves the unit chaplain who does an assessment. And on the spot, we often take that soldier airman right to an ER of a local hospital and ask for a 72-hour hold. This has happened on repeated occasions. Then we reach back out to the family. Hey, your soldier's been hospitalized for suicidal ideation. What kind of help can we provide for you? Then our director of psychological health gets involved with a call from the unit or the chaplain to follow up with that soldier post-release from the hospital. The state of Minnesota requires that if you're hospitalized for observation, a care plan has to be put together, and our psychological health provider looks over the care plan with the soldier and the unit to say this is what's being asked of you. And then the unit will follow up with the soldier, are you keeping these appointments? I'm really proud of what we do as a part-time force trying to provide full-time care. We've got a very good emergency response. Now, this response is great on our end, but it's only as good as the soldier following up in the community with the plan laid out for him. And there's the challenge for us as a part-time force. We are good at getting people to the hospital. They're civilians at that point. When they leave that hospital, they're not on drill status. This is where we desperately need our communities to help provide the services that are so needed for that soldier to regain resilience, or that airman, and rejoin us as a healthy member of the military.
Chaplain Morris, could you give us examples of individuals, men or women, that have gone through this and are still with you?
Do you have, how much time do you have?
Maybe not.
I deal with this really on a very regular basis. I'll talk to you about a young lady. These generally happen at 2 or 3 in the morning. often alcohol-related. This young woman exhibited some signs of distress to her unit. The unit called me. I called the young woman. Definitely having signs of real problems. I advised the unit, let's call the police. This is the last thing that young woman wanted. She's living at home with her family. She doesn't want police pulling up in front of her house. She doesn't want her family to know she's got a boatload of problems. I saw this young woman 2 months afterwards at her unit. All she could say to me was, thank you, you saved my life. I'm in regular counseling. Problems I had don't seem so big. I come back every week after counseling to the full-time force here at the Armory, let them know I made the appointment. This is my family. I've done 2 interventions off of Facebook where soldiers put something on Facebook. Their buddy saw the problem, called me. I alerted the unit. Same scenario. The unit reached out to the soldier. Both times, yes, I am suicidal. I'm asking for help through Facebook. The soldier was taken in by the unit to get care, still soldiering on in our ranks. We do a good job with triage. If you identify the need or we see it, we're all over it. It's that long-term care afterwards we're just not equipped to do as a part-time force.
Thank you. Appreciate your testimony, and thank you for being here today, and we'll move on to others. Have a good day.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senator Perry, thank you. And to the committee, thank you for calling attention to this issue, and call us any time to provide more information and data for you. And we want to wish you all happy holidays and Merry Christmas. Thank you.
Thank you, General. If Mr. Wolves could come forward to testify from the Department of Veteran Affairs. Welcome, Mr. Wolves. If you could identify yourself with the tape and go ahead with your testimony, we appreciate it. Thank you.
Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. I am Reggie Wolves, Deputy Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs. I wanted to take a few minutes this morning to provide you with the historical background that led up to creation of our successful CORE program, as well as an overview of the services provided through CORE. With me is Deborah Martin Schlor, Clinical Director, Metro Counseling and Family Resources for Lutheran Social Service, and an integral part of the LSS team that assists in the CORE program, which stands for Case Management, Outreach, Referral, and Education. After my brief introduction of this program, I'll turn things over to Deborah to provide details of the program, as well as a few case examples to help you better understand the services provided. This program was designed primarily as a case management program to provide assistance to veterans experiencing comprehensive issues and challenges. This was a need our department identified after several years of feedback, both internally as well as externally, from our partners in the field, including County Veterans Service Officers. In 2008, MDVA requested and secured funding from the Minnesota Legislature to develop a statewide case management program service to provide mental health, financial counseling, case management, respite care, and related services to families. An appropriation of $500,000 per year for 2 years was passed in the state budget. MDVA issued an RFP for a nonprofit partner in providing these services. LSS was selected as the VA partner in part because LSS was already providing quality mental health services around the state. The services were confidential in nature and could be provided immediately for crisis intervention at home, at work, or in the counseling office. The benefit to utilizing an organization like LSS for this type of service is being able to take advantage of their built-in network of services, which you'll hear a little more about from Deborah. One of the biggest services this provides is to bring care to rural areas of greater Minnesota. Another key factor for both military and veterans is the privacy of this program. The types of services provided include individual, family, and marriage counseling, and home counseling, addiction counseling, financial counseling, abuse counseling, and other types of trauma, resources, and referrals. CORE, the first of its kind program, is a joint partnership with the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs and Lutheran Social Service of Minnesota. The CORE program, again, which stands for Case Management, Outreach, Referral, and Education, provides free, confidential, and caring professional support available to veterans of all service eras, current or previous military service members and their families statewide, offered through a state-funded program. Office locations are available throughout Minnesota with qualified, experienced LSS staff and licensed mental health counselors offering flexible services when and where you need them most. Services can be offered in office, telephonically, and in-home as needed, helping over 1,500 clients last year. At this time, I would like to draw your attention to the supporting documents we have provided, as well as turn it over to Deborah, who will further explain the importance of this program, and also provide insight to a few specific cases as examples of the positive work occurring in and with this important program.
Would you identify yourself for the tape, please?
Good morning, Mr. Chair and representatives of the committee. I'm Deborah Martin-Schlar, Clinical Director of Metro Counseling and Family Resources at Lutheran Social Service, and a response for the CORE program.
Excuse me, could you pull the mic closer to you? So, thank you very much.
Is that better?
That's better.
Okay. Do you want me to repeat?
No, that's fine.
I'd like to start by just briefly summarizing some highlights from the demographics. I believe that it is in your packet regarding the program. And most noteworthy, I'd like to share that we have served a total of 3,541 individuals since the inception of this program. It is also noteworthy, I think, that in the last 2 years, since 2010-11, the rankings of the ages served, the service distribution categories, and the veteran status percentages have been consistent. And specifically, under ages served, those individuals 20 to 39 are the category of most individuals served, followed by 50 to 59, followed by 40 to 49, and 60 to 69. And the two top categories for service distribution, case management and counseling, both off-site and in-office, are the two top categories of utilization. And the veteran service eras, those from the Vietnam War era, number one, and OEF and OIF, number two. And additionally, more recently in the last 6 months, we've noted that we've served 62 counties statewide, and also noted that there's been an increase in serving clients with no insurance, and that is, of course, parallel to the community experience with health care coverage. Minnesota CORE is attributed to saving marriages, preventing bankruptcy, foreclosure, mitigating homelessness, and preventing 14 suicides. Our summary of sources identifying those interventions and those at risk include statewide numbers collected from our services statewide, representing both active military and veterans, and information gathered from client statements to CORE resources staff, client written expressions of gratitude and appreciation for the CORE program, and client satisfaction surveys. I'd like to illustrate some of the CORE work with three examples of client experience. A single male, age 28, contacted one of our CORE offices in the midst of feeling suicidal. He had access to a weapon and was sharing that he had been extremely depressed, very much long-term depression, was about to be evicted from his apartment and unemployed. He had also isolated himself from his previous supports in his family. The Corps counselor responded by arranging for some immediate psychiatric care to stabilize the risk, obtaining permission from the client to access the family members, and assist with their involvement, and to eventually arrange for a follow-up at the local VA for medication management and support for unemployment. Temporary housing was also arranged with his family, and the Corps counseling program engaged the family to encourage ongoing stabilization and support. A person I will call Joe, a Gulf War veteran, contacted his CVSO in a crisis when his adolescent daughter had attempted suicide and was at the hospital. The CVSO contacted our Corps counselor, who drove to the ER to be with the family and to address the multiple challenges and stressors they were stating were part of the crisis and concern. And those included the threat of eviction, the absence of basic needs, food, clothing, and also unemployment. Additionally, mother and father both reported that they were not able to parent at this time, that they felt overwhelmed and very much on the verge of divorce. The court counselor began to immediately respond with a plan at the hospital for some stabilization, and also linked the family with resources involving basic needs and also temporary housing. The ongoing impact of this is that the family was not only to basically manage the crisis but move into a greater strengthening relationship, and the couple is today together and more actively parenting and effectively parenting their children. And thirdly, a 56-year-old veteran contacted our Corps office after being laid off from his job of 18 years and was feeling rather hopeless, very, very depressed, very anxious. In assessing the situation, it was clear that he had undiagnosed depression and anxiety that had not been treated previously, in addition to his looming mortgage foreclosure crisis. The link was made with our financial counseling services, internal to LSS, to assist with the mortgage bankruptcy crisis and also ongoing debt management. The couple were able to move to the next level of making some decisions, and today are still in their home and still together. In talking with colleagues and also a lot of the support for the program that we wish for continuing, we've thought about what might be additionally helpful in terms of the core response and interface with services. And that would be increasing, enhancing services to young adults. Young adults are the demographic and in general in our service delivery system that have less services available to them. Lots for children, lots for older adults, not much for young adults. Secondly, wondering about more support for older veterans, particularly Vietnam-era veterans who are seeking a lot of connective tissue and support and are often very isolated. And thirdly, we wonder about the increased awareness of primary care physicians and clinic settings to know about CORE and how to access CORE, particularly in the rural communities, as many of our CORE soldiers and families at primary care are arriving with multiple stressors and heightened stressors, and we may certainly be of help to address, assess, and manage some of that experience. So in summary, I would like to very much say that we believe the CORE program has been responsive to multiple needs, individuals and families' well-being and stability, and we thank you very much for your support of this program.
Thank you, Ms. Schlohr and Mr. Wills. Any questions from the committee?
Mr. Chair?
Senator Wieger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
comment on the funding. I believe it's $500,000 or so. There's a limit of 20 counseling sessions. Do we have an appropriate funding amount? Should there be any changes in terms of how we effectively address this serious problem? If there's a limit, maybe there, and I believe you try to get third-party reimbursement where there's eligibility, but I'm not sure how successful that's been. So if you could comment on the resources that you have now and what you would ideally have if we're to more effectively address this.
Mr. Wills?
Mr. Chair, Mr. Senator, we have taken a look at the program and how it is currently funded. Over the past couple of years, we have experienced levels of shortfall for the program. However, we've been able to address that need both internally and also with our partnership with the National Guard. As we take a look at current funding, I would say at this point it is not something that we're concerned with. However, as time goes on and the need continues to increase, you know, it may become a concern. So at this point in time, we're looking at internal fixes in order to address the issue again. But however, as we go on, you know, it's going to be a continuing issue as we see it in the future. As Commissioner Shelton will speak to a little bit later, we're looking at a drawdown of forces from the current conflict in Iraq. More people are going to be coming back and accessing an already heavily taxed system, both at the state level and the federal level. And we're going to have to work in unison to address that, to ensure that we're taking care of those that need the assistance.
Senator Weir, follow.
Well, no, Ms. Chair, we'll look for your recommendations. We'll assume you know how the process works. If there's a need for additional resources to combat this, and if you feel internally it's under control, we'll take your word for it.
Thank you, sir.
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just have a question for the Lutheran Social Service person. Do you have veterans involved in your process and outreach working with you?
Ms. Schlauer?
Yes, Representative and Mr. Chairman. Yes, we do. In fact, on our Metro team of resources and the core program, there are three veterans who are also mental health professionals, and that is mirrored throughout the state in different locations.
Any further questions from the committee? Mr. Wills and Ms. Schlauer, thank you for coming today. I appreciate your testimony, and we'll take this all into consideration. And if the next testifier... I've been informed that we're going to jump to our Skype individual, Mr. Greg Roberts. I believe he's from Bemidji. That's going to be coming in. So if we can bring him up onto the overhead and hear his testimony, that would be great. Good morning, Mr. Roberts. Could you identify yourself for the tape? Good morning, Mr. Roberts. Could you identify yourself for the tape and go ahead and give your testimony?
Good morning. My name is Gregory Roberts. I was a staff sergeant with the Minnesota Army National Guard. I served in Bosnia 2003-2004, in Iraq 2006-2007. I'm currently a doctoral student at Northwestern College of Chiropractic.
Please go ahead with your testimony.
Okay. Like I said, I was part of the 1st Brigade Combat Team in 06-07, the longest combat tour in OIF history. And we were held over there as part of the surge, so we got a little bit of extra special treatment. that we weren't anticipating. But I just want to relate to you my experience coming home, what that was like for me and some of my fellow soldiers to try to help you guys make a better decision on what to do. Some of the things that stand out in my mind, number one would be the fact that when you're gone for nearly 2 years, you spend so much time thinking about home, and it's one of those things that keeps you going on those bad days, and there's plenty of those bad days to be had. And when you get home, the thing that you don't realize and you did not expect is that home is actually not what you remember it to be. It's the same, but you're different. And it's just a different experience for you. It's being home is the second war that nobody talks about. It's an incredibly difficult thing, and you have no idea about it. You expect everything to be better when you get home, and suddenly you're realizing that it's not. It's a tremendous blow to what it's... the thing about this is we had about a week stateside before we were shoved back into our former lives. It wasn't really a whole lot of time to reintegrate. You know, we were still stuck in uniform. We were still stuck on an Army post doing the Army thing. And we didn't really have a chance to try to meld our military lives and our civilian lives. We basically got put on a bus, sent home, and we did a ceremony, we were released, and that was it. There was no real contact after that until our first drill. My own personal experience, when I came home, I ended up skipping out on my first two reintegration drills on the way home simply because the idea of putting a uniform on made me sick to my stomach. There was a terrible amount of anxiety that led up to the days before guard drills. This ended up really affecting my drill status down the road. I drank profusely for 3 or 4 months after returning because I could not have fun any other way. It was the only way that I could relax and enjoy myself. I did eventually identify that myself and a lot of my friends who the only place that I would see them was the bar. These are all my Army buddies. I didn't end up eventually stopping that habit, but the thing is that nobody around me I could relate to. It was basically like an alien on Earth. I didn't feel like anybody understood what I was going through, with the exception of my Army buddies that I actually served with. Not ones that had served prior and had been in different wars, just the guys that I was with, because our experience was unique. Our experience was different from even our sister company or our sister battalions. Everybody had a completely different experience. My war was very different from the war of my neighbor who served in 2003-2004. I didn't feel like I could relate to him. The problem with this is that I was not in a position to have contact with them. A lot of them lived locally. Yeah, they were nearby, but due to the nature of PTSD and avoidance that goes along with it, you just avoid every situation, every stimulus that is associated with that which you don't want to remember. You know, in my case, the war. The stimulus, my buddies, a uniform. I avoided them like the plague. They avoided me as well. We all avoided each other. And it created this situation where we're all hurting in our own ways, and we knew the only people that we could really relate to were each other, but we didn't want to see each other. We didn't want to have anything to do with each other just because that brings up those old memories. So that made a very difficult situation. And the tragedy is they're truly the only ones that could really help. They understood what I was going through, and I was understanding what they were going through, but there was no contact between us. They are, your Army buddies, the ones you serve with, they're the best of preventing suicide, you know, quite honestly. You know, like these reintegration drills that they tried to have, I skipped out on them. Did anybody call me? No. Did anybody say, hey, you need to come to this, you're accountable? Why didn't you come? Are you okay? Are you at home sucking on a long end of a 12-gauge? Nobody asked me that. There was no ramification for that. There was no contact. There was no nothing. You know, that actually, in retrospect, is quite a disservice when I think about it. But anyway, I've been listening to a little bit of the testimony so far, and I've been relating some of this experience to myself, and it quite honestly kind of has me frazzled, and I would prefer to just open myself up to some questions that you guys might have, because the only thing I can really tell you is my own personal experiences, and I don't know how applicable they are going to be. And if you guys just have some questions you want to throw at me, maybe I can do my best to answer them.
Mr. Roberts, you had it was indicated to me by my committee administrator that you had experience with the suicide of one of your friends or buddies, and I'm sorry for that situation, and my condolences to you and to his family. Just if it doesn't hurt too much to share a little bit about what you knew of before he committed suicide, or if what his things that were happening in his life, or was it totally unexpected?
Right. Jesse's death was completely and totally unexpected. It was a shock to everybody. We all knew that he had some family issues, so there was another factor in there in that suicide, but the fact is he had served two combat tours in Iraq. He did one with the 10th Mountain Division, I believe. No, I take that back. It was the 1st Cav. And then he did deploy with us, so he had two separate tours, coupled with the fact that he had family issues and a drinking problem. And you had a cocktail for suicide right there. The tragedy of that is, like, you know, I was talking about this avoidance. We're all avoiding each other. Well, the one day we did not avoid each other was the day after Jesse killed himself. We all came together, and we started talking about it, trying to make some sense of it. And everybody had a little piece of the puzzle that led up to Jesse Davis's suicide. We all saw little things that, when we put them all together, could have identified the fact that he was going to do this to himself. And what we can learn from this is if we had actually been staying in touch with each other, we would have identified that in him a lot, you know, before he had done it, and we possibly could have saved him. But that's the nature of the avoidance that goes along with PTSD, with this whole subject, is that we're the ones that can take care of it, but we just don't want to have anything to do with it.
Mr. Roberts, what was Jesse Davis's job in the military?
Jesse Davis, during our deployment, he was the team leader, an infantry team leader. And I believe with his prior deployment, he was a specialist, so he'd have been like a rifleman, just a grunt.
Okay. Senator Perry?
Thank you. First and foremost, Mr. Roberts, thank you for your service. We all appreciate that. But my question to you is, as we sit here and have heard from General Nash, we've heard from those in the Lutheran Social Services, and in speaking with Commissioner Shalito, can you give us, we've heard about the 30, 60, 90-day timelines. Can you give us an idea of how long you have now been set back? And are there certain, and I think Representative Creasel and I talked a little bit about this, are there certain periods of time that you have experienced that you believe others experienced that there should be some kind of intervention? And if so, what that might be?
Okay, so just so I understand your question, you want to know, like, certain, like, events that occur yearly that, like, set me off, or...
Well, I think that would be, Mr. Roberts, or Mr. Chair, I think that would be what I would be looking for, because as we've been explained, we have a program right now, but it's a short period of time. And how there's got to be some events. I think Representative Kriesel mentioned what happens a year from when they're out. What are we doing at that point in time? Maybe a year and a half. And I'm not quite sure how long you have been separated here from the service.
Mr. Roberts.
Right. Well, I've been out of the Guard for over 3 years now, and we've been home for over 4 years now. And I'll tell you this right now. One day that bothers me every year is September 28th, because that's the day that Jesse shot himself. So that's an obvious one. Veterans Day, Memorial Day, I think about these things. The end of the Iraq War, I thought about it. Those things are all stimulants that set me back. And doing what I'm doing right now, quite honestly, like the last 4 days, I've been terribly anxious, you know, just over having to think about my experiences, things that I don't want to think about, but that's part of the healing process. What I'm doing right now with you guys is part of my healing process, and hopefully it'll help some other veterans in the future. But as far as, like, relating, like, when I first came home, it took me over a year before I finally admitted to myself that, hey, I've got a problem and I need to go see somebody about it. And even then, I didn't do anything about it until I had had half a dozen panic attacks and actually went to the ER a couple times, convinced I had a heart attack. And the funny thing about this is that I knew about PTSD. I understood it. I had studied it. I was working on a master's in psychology before I deployed. It was something that I was familiar with. And yet I was resistant to the idea that it could be happening to me. So it took me quite a while to actually accept that and to seek out help for it. But then again, like, I had to do it. I had to identify it in myself. I had to recognize these things. So soldiers aren't going to reach out, for the most part, aren't going to reach out. They need to understand what they're going to go through so that when they experience it, they can go and identify it in themselves, and they can reach out and seek the help that they need.
Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Roberts, thank you for your service. We appreciate that. And thank you for the courage to tell your story. I think it's really important. If I remember correctly, you're a member of the Red Bulls?
Yes.
Is there anything specific that we could do at the local guard unit level in the individual communities where we have, like in Bemidji?
Mr. Roberts?
Specifically at the unit level, the soldiers, team leaders, squad leaders, platoon leaders, each individual soldier needs to be, they need to understand the issues that people are going to face when returning from a war zone. If you're in a unit with combat vets and you're not a combat vet, you still need to understand what they might be experiencing when they come home. I understand there's some units that will only deploy like a handful of soldiers, maybe half the company, and when they come back, they're going to be integrated with non-combat vets. Those guys need to understand what these guys are going to be going through when they come home. That's going to be their biggest support group, the other buddies they have in uniform. You know, that's going to be the big thing. Like, they're the ones you guys should be targeting. They are the ones that are going to make the difference between life and death.
Senator Carlson, follow up?
No. Thank you, Mr. Roberts.
Senator Goodman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Roberts, I just have to tell you that this written testimony that you submitted is so well done that it really is easy to understand what soldiers, returning soldiers, are going through. And I think if they had something like this, like your written testimony, so they kind of knew what to expect, and that they very much benefit by it and understand that they're not they're not sticking out there alone with these same issues that you had when you came home, and at least they'd be a little bit more prepared to go out and get help if they had a real understanding, and you've written it out so well that it's so easy to understand what you were going through. My question is did you ever get any follow-up calls from the guard after you returned from any professionals at the guard just to check up and see if you were, how you were doing, or did you get any information like this before you returned from the guard?
Mr. Roberts?
Well, first of all, thank you. I wish I could speak better than I could write. In fact, I was reading my testimony before, you know, doing this verbal one with you guys, and I kind of thought to myself, I can't really say it any better than this. How can they expect me to you know, verbalize this? So luckily you guys have that. But I never received any follow-up from my unit or the VA. In fact, I had, and I don't want to, I'm not going to point anybody out or anything right here, but I want to use my experience as a lesson for everybody else. I had accepted a promotion in a unit other than the one that I deployed with, which meant 3 months after my return from Iraq, I was to go to a different unit to drill. And I was having some, you know, some serious issues, and I did not go to drill. I straight up just, you know, didn't do it. I made excuses before eventually I did contact my unit, and I leveled with them, and I said, hey, I'm going to the VA, I'm seeing a psychiatrist, they diagnosed me with PTSD, I have these issues, and the only reason I'm telling you guys is because, you know, I have responsibility to you, and you need to understand this, so hopefully you can give me some leniency. And initially, they seemed to be very receptive to it. They said, hey, you know what? You do what you got to do. Don't worry about it. But then a week right before my separation date, before my ETS date, a week before that, I received a dishonorable discharge from the National Guard in the mail, which was a complete surprise to me. I did eventually fight that and had that overturned, luckily. But what if I was on the verge of being suicidal and my unit did that to me and I had decided to take my life? Would that have been the spark? I don't know. That's just an unnecessary stress to take somebody that is experiencing something directly related to their service and to give them a dishonorable discharge as a result of behavior, you know, following from that issue. It just blows my mind. It really blows my mind. It made me physically ill when I got that letter in the mail. I'm just glad that General Shelto's office, you know, I appealed to them and they did overturn it. You know, and that made me feel better, but still, you know, the unit should have been more sensitive to the issue. They should have at least called me or emailed me or reached out in some way and said, hey, man, are you doing okay? Is there anything we can do for you? Maybe you should come on in and talk to us, you know. They didn't do that at all. They didn't seem to have the least bit of interest in me, you know. On one hand, I can't blame them because, you know, I was supposed to be a squad leader in their unit, and I can understand how they would have been upset. I get that. But that was out of my control at the point. I was seriously mentally ill.
Senator Goodwin.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a follow-up. Thank you for describing that, Mr. Roberts. Just a follow-up to that, do you know if that practice of giving a dishonorable discharge if you don't show up for drills is mandated at the top of the Guard? Is that a normal process, or is that something that is peculiar to Minnesota Guard?
Mr. Roberts?
Honestly, I have no idea. I couldn't answer that one.
because I'm just
a good one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, because I agree with you that that it sounds like the military in general is not taking into consideration or not totally understanding what the issues can be when you come home. And I'm sure there's many different ways of PTSD displaying itself, but certainly seems to me that it would be important to, particularly with people that are just done serving, to do follow-up on with them, and certainly not automatically discharge without knowing if they have a problem at this time. So thank you. I appreciate your testimony.
Thank you.
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Greg, for being here and talking, and quite frankly, you got me flashing back to conversations with some of my fellow Vietnam vets. Sounds very similar to me. I have one real simple question for you, and that is, how many of your fellow Iraq vets do you think have PTSD?
Mr. Roberts?
I would say I know at least 10 guys out of my platoon, for sure, that have had symptoms. Out of my squad, I know at least 6 of the guys in my squad. I would say better than 60% in a line unit, in an infantry unit. Non-infantry units, I can't really speak for, but you know, everybody's experience is different. You could be in a non-infantry unit and get tugged outside the wire and see some, you know, pretty bad stuff. So,
Representative Purcell.
Thank you, Greg. That comports with my experience too. And certainly in the early years, PTSD wasn't recognized. And we can go back to WW1. I got a paper on that. And Colonel Whittlesey in the Lost Battalion come home, killed himself. Had an uncle, WW2, D-Day, come home, killed himself. And many more PTSD cases out here from all of our conflicts. And it's recognized. And we need to get on top of that. That's the only point I wanted to make.
Senator Perry?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Mr. Roberts, could you... Have you followed? I'm thinking right now that some might be thinking that there isn't anything being done, even after the testimony that we had from General Nash. Have you followed some of the changes that are happening, both with the Minnesota National Guard and their direction, and Commissioner Shelato and DMBA in their direction to address exactly what you're talking about here? Have you followed that,
Mr. Roberts?
Admittedly, no.
Okay. Well, I just wanted to advise everyone to realize that this is great testimony. We're finding things out, but in the meetings that I personally have had, I'm impressed at the action that's currently being taken by Commissioner Shelato and General Nash, because they understand this. Unfortunately, I think Mr. Roberts was one of those folks that there wasn't a very strong organization to work with them. But I would suggest, Mr. Roberts, that if you have friends, more heroes like yourself, that you know, that maybe it would be great to contact Commissioner Shelato and General Nash and say, hey, here's my buddies. I love them. I'm concerned about them. We fought together, and I'm just thinking, will somebody reach out to them? Because I think you can be a key catalyst in this right now.
Mr. Roberts, any final words before we dismiss?
No, I've put it all in writing. I hope hope that I've said something at least that, that can stimulate a little, you know, controversy or good effort. And I don't want to sound like a whiner or anything. I just I want to do something good for the guys that are still in service. And there's plenty of them that I serve with that are still wearing boots. So they deserve everything they can get. And thank you for the Vietnam vets. If it weren't for those guys, we would have had a real heck of a time coming home.
Well, thank you, Mr. Roberts. Thank you for your service. Thank you for your testimony today. And again, our condolences to the loss of your good friend. And as Senator Perry did mention, hope that you'll make an effort to contact the Guard, General Nash, or the military affairs, and talk to them, especially for the sake of your buddies and friends. And again, have a Merry Christmas.
Thank you. You too.
Well, at this venture, we'll ask the adjutant, former adjutant general, Commissioner Larry Shalito, to come forward for the Department of Veterans Affairs.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Detmer.
Yeah, maybe as the general Shalito comes up, I'd like to just give an answer to Senator Goodwin's question over there regarding the Army does have a policy when I'm a retired reservist, and I have twin sons that are currently in the military, and they do have a policy. If you don't show up for drill, that your first-line leader, who's ever in charge of you, is to call you and find out why you're not at drill. That's an Army policy. Every unit follows those, and if in his case, if it didn't happen, was somebody dropped the ball. But there is Army policy that you do contact the person's home and find out why they're not at drill. So, and if they miss so many mutas or so many drills, you can be discharged, you know, out of the military. That's part of the policy. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Detmer. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Shalito, and welcome to
Chair Anderson.
Lively debate.
My name is Larry Shalito, Commissioner of Veterans Affairs. We have two testimonies today. I'll save my prepared comments for the end of the second one. But I do want to say that you have been given a gift right now with Greg's testimony. He has clearly stated very clearly and concisely the future that you are going to experience. And I know John here, you can ask him at the end. But let me give you the context. The war in 2001 started. We went into Afghanistan, parachuted in, and all of that type of good stuff. Then we go into Iraq. When it first started, there was no welcome home whatsoever. And when Greg referred to the Thank You Vietnam Veterans, they were the ones that were first angry and then all of a sudden said, no way are we going to allow our troops to come back home unappreciated. So we did that. You are correct. When they came back home, because I was the adjutant general at that time, I would say, we want you to come back for a 30, 60, 90-day thing. Now, why 30, 60, and 90? One is because that's the only funding we got. Every month, we were allowed our mutas, our four mutas, our drill weekends, if you will, and that was the only possible way I thought we could bring them back and look them in the eye. Okay? Following me? Well, the big money crunchers up in DOD, Department of Defense, said we can capture all of those money because they did what everyone would expect. They asked the troops, what do you want? When you come home from war, what do you want? And if anyone wants to challenge me on this one, take it on. I'll take it on. Those troops would look those people in the eye and says, just leave me alone. Just leave me alone. I had to personally fight the Yellow Ribbon program because it was a boutique program. Nothing that would be permanently funded. You can predict the future. All of the things like that. It was then Senator Dayton who worked in, and he knew somebody, and he partnered with Ted Stevens, You got both ends of the spectrum. He got some money, and that gave us the adrenaline or the extra money in order to keep the program going. And then all of a sudden, and that was about $2 million. Then all of a sudden, DOD started hearing from the families, and they then funded it on the national level for $435 million. And they kind of screwed it up, personally and professionally. So what's happening is, Greg's just normal. He wanted to be left alone. He didn't know what he wanted to do. Many times, I would say the Guard saved my life. Because when I joined the Guard, I was a Vietnam veteran back from there. I didn't have anyone to talk to. All my teammates, I worked with five other guys for a year out in the middle of nowhere. They were all in five different parts of the country. The first thing I learned was to keep my mouth shut and not talk about it because the Main Street people just didn't understand. Or they read a book about it and wanted to express their opinion. But in the Guard, it was funny because there's always two or three or four more Vietnam vets. And my Vietnam vets, you're going to have to back me up on this. But we would sit there and we'd throw a case of beer on the floor. We'd sit, drink a few beers, and we would tell war stories. That was my therapy. Telling the war stories, but walking out, not even realizing it because no one had a summary comment, is that we were normal. We were absolutely normal. So when he thanks the Vietnam vets, it was just those saying, hey, we have to get all these things. Now, the concern of this state, and this state is a national leader. When I look at all the other states, we are many, many light years ahead of some of the other states. So you can imagine what's going on there. But as they start coming home, and I'll be talking about this, is the tsunami effect. Yesterday, the war in Iraq ended. 1975, the war in Vietnam ended. Guess what? Y'all get to go home. I am predicting you're going to start to hear the phrase RIF, reduction in force. Already the recruiters are talking about, well, we'll only take future officers from the academies and the ROTC program. Or we may be very, very selective. Yes, it's already started. You're going to start hearing, because of the personnel costs, that they are going to diminish people and start sending them home. I signed up for a 20-year career. Sorry, you're going to get out of it at 14 years. That all happened, and we have enough historians in the room that have lived that and know what I'm talking about. So what's happening is that the Guard and Reserve, the reserve components in the state of Minnesota represents about 22,000 boots on the ground. They represent 40% of the military that is committed, that are Minnesota residents, or claim Minnesota as a residency. That 40% are no longer going to be deployed. The other 60% is going to start to be pushing back. And all of a sudden, you're going to start to see this tsunami effect hit the resources. Corps is the first step of a triage system, and General Nash's testimony was excellent. It shaped the battle very, very clearly. It's a very serious one. But we need systems in place. Corps right now is the first line of defense. When I started this, we had ideations on the floor. We would take them off the floor. We would take them to the hospital. The first question asked was, what is your insurance policy? We literally had to put troops in jail because that's the only place we felt they would take them. So as you look at this, I would work with General Nash, and I will work with the Department of Health and Human Services and so forth to shape the battle for the returning troops that are coming back home. And what we could expect of our health care providers so that these young people would take it off. I hope you have a tape of that. And I hope you periodically replay that. And so that's my unprepared comments. So subject to any questions on CORE, I will take that.
Any questions for Commissioner Shalito? Okay, I guess not. You're doing well. Our next testifier is Mr. John Baker.
you, Mr. Chair. It's an honor to be in front of you. To
please identify yourself for the tape.
Again, my name is John Baker. I'm a retired United States Marine Corps Gunnery Sergeant. I spent 22 years in the Marine Corps. And I note there's at least one other Marine in the room, Mr. Cleary. I appreciate the backup. I'm probably outnumbered. I'm retired from the Marine Corps, and after I retired, I went to law school. I now have a general practice where I focus on representing veterans in Minnesota. A large part of my practice is representing veterans in the criminal justice system. I'm also chair of the Minnesota State Bar Association Military Law Committee. I've been tasked by the president of the MSBA to liaison with our bar in the state of Minnesota in veterans issues. That's part of what brings me here today. I also chaired the initiative to start veteran courts in Minnesota. I started chairing that a couple years ago, and as many of you know, July of 2010, we had our first veteran court started in Minnesota in Hennepin County. And I do note that I believe a number of you have been able to participate in that or go watch that court and see how well it's doing. I'm also a member of the Military Action Group, and a large part of my practice as well is I go around the state and teach folks that are involved in the legal system, the criminal justice system, how to deal with veterans. How to identify veterans is one of the biggest things. And one of the things I do when I go around the state is as Commissioner Shalito noted, that we have a tsunami coming forward, and we in the legal system are going to have a lot of work ahead of us. And one of the things I'm very careful when I talk to folks is we have to do this right. We have to make sure that we're not going to ruin this for veterans that are going to be coming down the pike. As many of you know, we have a great wave of support of veterans right now. That it hasn't always been there. My 22 years in the Marine Corps, most of my career, we didn't have that support. I came in right after Vietnam, and we didn't have that kind of support. And I want to be very careful with this. So one of the things I ensure that I'm teaching attorneys and those involved in the legal system is how to properly identify a veteran, which is a little bit more tricky than what we know. But one of the things I want to say as well too is that we do have our next greatest generation coming back from these wars in Iraq and Afghanistan. Every generation has had their greatest that have gone off to wars, but I can't help but think about I'm a mentor to a third year law student at the University of St. Thomas Law School. He started his first semester of law school and had to drop out because he got orders to go back to Iraq. He was a Marine with the MP Company out of Fort Snelling. He had already done one successful tour, came back. School, got into law school, but he got orders to go back. Well, he gladly dropped out of law school and went to Iraq, did his year, came back home, and got successfully back into law school. I can't help but think about two guys in 1941, their first semester of law school at the University of Minnesota Law School, World War II broke out. They both dropped out of law school and both joined the Marine Corps and both went to fight in the Pacific. One of them was severely wounded, but came back home and became successful. He became governor of Minnesota, a guy by the name of Orville Freeman. The other one was R.W. Johnson, who went on to become the longtime county attorney in Anoka County. It's exciting to me that we've got this generation coming home from these wars in Iraq right now that are going to do this very same thing. But as General Nash noted, we have a very high unemployment rate. We have barriers to our service members that are coming back home, and I believe it's up to us in the legal community and in the legislature to help break down those barriers. So a lot of work that I've done at the MAG group that I know that the chair is familiar with is how do we break down those barriers, and one of the things that we did when I started chairing the veteran court a few years ago is we need to create a program for veterans that are getting in in trouble with the criminal justice system. The fact is that there are veterans with PTSD. Now, mind you, I'm going to talk about this, but most of our veterans are successful in coming back. But there are some that have PTSD, have TBI, and are getting in trouble with the criminal justice system. My law office represented a Navy CB who was a reservist and got activated in 2003 and fought with the Marines up into Baghdad in the initial fight up into Baghdad. Well, I'll call him Dirk. Dirk, when he came back home from the wars, he was asked as he transitioned back through Camp Pendleton if he had any mental health issues, and this was back at the time where it was just the check the box. We now have a much, much better program, but he checked the box no. You know, if he would have checked the box yes, he would have likely have been kept back. Mm-hmm. He checked the box no. He came back home, and within a month, he had contact with the criminal justice system. He had a ticket for driving on the wrong side of the road, which isn't very surprising. You imagine yourself in driving down the streets in Baghdad one day, where as part of evasive maneuvers, you're going to move over to the other side of the road because there may be some kid that's going to throw some kind of rock or an IED or an IED is going to go off on the right side. So you're going to all of a sudden flash back and do evasive maneuvers and go over to the other side. Well, you know, do that on 494 a couple weeks after you get back from Baghdad, that's not going to go too well. Well, Dirk got, a couple months after that, Dirk got arrested for DWI. He then had a couple other touches with the criminal justice system. Never once was Dirk identified as a veteran through that process. About a year later, the unfortunate thing happened. Dirk killed his girlfriend in a fit of rage. He also tried to kill himself. He obviously wasn't successful because now Dirk is in Stillwater for the rest of his life with diagnosed and untreated PTSD. My point is he was never identified as a veteran in the criminal justice system. I have another client that I'm representing right now. I'll call him Jake. Jake is a two-tour Iraq War veteran. His second tour coming back from Iraq, he got back in early 2010. Jake got into school. He's at the University of one of the universities here, and he's being very successful. He's done all the reintegration programs. Never had any difficulty until he couldn't sleep anymore. It's some triggering event that happened, and he couldn't sleep anymore. He just could not sleep. And Jake, after about a week of not being able to sleep, he said, "Okay, I'm going to go. Finally, I'm going to go to the VA. All the reintegration stuff, they told me, if you need help, go get help. If you need help, go get help. You know, the VA's got some great programs." Well, Jake packed a bag on a Friday morning and drove to the Minneapolis VA. He sat in the parking lot of the VA for 2 hours before he went in, just getting up the courage to go in. And I will bet you right now, you go to that big, huge parking lot at the VA, and you'll find men and women just getting up the courage to walk into that huge building, because it's very intimidating if you've never been in there. Well, he went in there and checked in, but he did not trigger any suicidal or homicidal ideations at that time. So they sent him home. They sent him home. 5 days later, still on no sleep, he's in the Dakota County Jail, just having been charged with five felonies of trying to steal some cars, and it was pretty obvious to me that he was trying to kill himself.
Mr. Baker, could you wrap it up a little bit here?
Yes, sir.
Thank you.
So he was not the Minnesota National Guard, or I'm sorry, he's in the Wisconsin National Guard. His unit is now making motions or doing stuff to kick him out of the military. We have two new tools in Minnesota. We have the Veteran Sentencing Mitigation Statute, which is used throughout the state to help veterans get connected with resources that are in the criminal justice system, and we have veteran courts. The veteran court has been very successful. We've got the one of the keys to that is we have the Veteran Justice Outreach Program, which is part of the VA now. that's connecting with the Minneapolis program, and we're successfully getting veterans connected into that program. Why do I tell you this, and why am I talking about this today? I will just tell you that I was in a courtroom about 3 weeks ago down in Dakota County. I was representing a Marine combat veteran, four tours in Iraq and Afghanistan, Silver Star winner, in trouble with the criminal justice system, and I had a prosecutor that didn't, and this guy's been diagnosed with PTSD, I had a prosecutor that didn't believe that PTSD was a mental health issue. I had a judge that had never heard of the Veteran Sentencing Mitigation Statute, and I had a probation officer that had never heard of the Veteran Sentencing Mitigation Statute. My point is, I think with the programs that we have for suicide prevention in Minnesota, we need to connect the MDVA and the Guard with our criminal justice programs and our criminal justice systems that are going on right now. That is not happening right now that I know of. And that's what I think is absolutely critical. We've got a lot of folks in the attorneys that are going out and teaching the judiciary about how to identify veterans. But I'd like to what I'd like this committee to do is ask the MDVA to have some kind of veteran justice outreach program as well to connect with the veterans in the criminal justice system. And with that, I'll wrap it up. Sorry I took so long, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Baker. Any questions from Mr. Baker at this point? Thank you for your testimony. Thank you for coming today. We're running over time, but we're going to continue on, and we have a Miss Mary Claire Lindberg to come and testify.
Good morning, senators and representatives, ladies and gentlemen. I have been here since the start of this proceeding. And
could you identify yourself for the tape, please?
My name is Mary Claire Lindberg. I am the mother of Sergeant Benjamin John Miller, who took his life on June 18th of 2008. He was in the Army. I have no prepared speech. I don't think I would have been able to read what I would have prepared at this point anyway. I simply am here as a mother to say to you that I feel so much more needs to be done. And as I listen to each and every one of you talk about what is being done, I see the spots and holes where our communication system is failing. One hand does not seem to know what the other hand is doing. I have a son who was serving his second tour of duty in Iraq. During his first tour of duty in Iraq, he had some very traumatic situations happen to them. The most impressive for him was holding his friend, PFC, Andrew Kempel, in his arms as he passed away. They, just before they were loaded onto their Humvees, were asked by their sergeant to change positions. And as they went in, Drew was shot in the head by sniper fire. My son held him in his arms as he died. He also lost another one of the point men on a convoy he was on. When they returned on September 11th of 2006, my son was obviously suffering from post-traumatic stress disorder. During the year between his two tours, they spent so much time trying to medically correct and emotionally correct and help my son to just sleep through the night. They even removed him from the base and set him off base and changed medications again and again. I'd like to tell you what the different medications were. I would like to tell you where they moved him to. However, each and every time I try and obtain this information, I am given back copies where everything has been crossed off. But the name of my son, the date of his birth, and the date of his death, that's information I already know. My son was to get out of the service in December of 2007, and in September, which was the year after he had been back, they said to him, "You're going back to Iraq." And he said to them, "I'm all set for school. I'm signed up at the University of Minnesota. I'm thinking about my girlfriend. And they said, don't worry, and they sent him back. And when Ben got back to Iraq, they told him he was a victim of the stop-loss program and that he would be serving another year. That March, they came to Ben and they said to him, we see you're having problems dealing with the stress of this. We would like you to speak to someone. And Ben went back and thought about it, and being a sergeant, thought to himself, how can I expect my men to stand up and soldier on, and I'm seeing someone for help? And he declined it. I don't understand why at that point in time they didn't pick him up and take him out of there. Instead, they chose in June to send him back home on R&R to a state where there is no military base to speak of for him to turn to when he needed help. And one evening, he went to a baseball game with his brother. And from the time they left until about 4 hours later, Ben went downhill. He determined that he couldn't go back to Iraq. He didn't quite know what to do. His final words were, I can't pick up any more baby parts. He picked up a revolver and he shot himself in the head. I feel there were many opportunities for the military to save my son. I am now involved in enough programs to know that my son is not an unusual soldier. All research I've done since my son has passed away has told me that our numbers of combat suicides, our military suicides, is higher than our numbers of combat deaths. And in the 3.5 years since my son has died, it continues to rise. In my research, I've learned that there are things that can be done. I'm not sure exactly how it works, but a blood draw can show a suicidal person. Why aren't we doing blood draws on the 0, 30, 60, 90 day? A CAT scan can be obtained that will show how neurons are firing differently in a suicidal person. If it's an expense, I would have paid for it, gladly. I hear of these things. I hear of military step downs on bases such as Ben's Fort Campbell, where they close the base down for 3 days and everyone on base attends a 3-day suicide prevention seminar. It was followed up by, I believe, the same type of setting in Nevada. That was it. We find something to do to help our soldiers, and we give it a cursory effort, and then we stop. I'm not anybody but Ben's mom. I'm confused by the fact that we're still in the situation where we have military suicide rising and rising, and we know so much more than we did years ago. I would like to just conclude with this statement. Along with many grieving mothers, I ask why. Why is the death rate by suicide in the military challenging the death rate from combat? Why isn't the military more diligent about the mental welfare of its members? It cares for them in so many other ways. The military clothes them, it shelters them, it feeds them, trains them, and even educates them. Some members in the military are living in conditions much better than they lived in their own homes. It provides them with financial compensation and the prospect of future benefits and with some of the most advanced medical treatment. But in this last provision, it fails in at least one important aspect. We are told that my son was offered mental treatment after he was withdrawn from the combat area and showed signs of some degree of emotional distress. We're told that he declined. Apparently, he did not want to seem less macho. I wonder, why was he the one permitted to make such a significant decision as to whether he needed help or not? Is it not the decision that should be made by a trained, qualified mental psychologist who could have obtained the treatment he so desperately needed? Isn't it something someone other than my son should have decided? And why are we still talking about this?
Thank you, Ms. Lindbergh. Any members have some questions for Ms. Lindbergh? Our condolences to you and your family, and we'll continue this issue as long as there are men and women who serve, and we'll try and get to the bottom of it.
I would like to say that I know that is all my son and I can ask, is that we do something to prevent what happened in our family to any other family. No one should go through this.
Thank you. Thank you. Our next testifier is Ms. Shelley Martin. Ms. Martin, if you could identify yourself with the tape and then go ahead with your testimony.
My name is Shelley Martin. I am here on behalf of Major Tad Hervis's family, who was unable to attend today.
Thank you for coming in.
I went to college with Major Hervis, and I know him quite well. And on October 6, 2009, I received a phone call from his father telling me that Tad was dead and I needed to contact his friends. Well, we came to find out later that Tad Hervis had committed suicide after receiving a reprimand from his higher up while deployed in Iraq. After he received this reprimand, they allowed him to walk across the base with his loaded 9mm to go back and pack his bags so he could be transported to Baghdad. He never made it on that helicopter. He took the gun, went to an isolated spot on the base, put the gun to his head, and pulled the trigger. After we found out about his death, we sought for information. We called, we wrote, we did everything we possibly could. The Army said go to the National Guard. The National Guard said go to the Army. We finally received a report 10 months after his death, hundreds of pages long, redacted. Sections of the report have been removed under some military ordinance. It's just a bunch of holes. It's been over 2 years, and we still do not have all the answers surrounding the reprimand that was given to him by his highest command as to what transpired. He left four notes. The military, the National Guard, took those notes, redacted them before giving them to his family. The delays that the military caused was such stress on his father. He died 10 months after Tad. The cause of death, they said, was he died from the stress and a broken heart from his son and dealing with the military. We still, to this day, do not have those reports. We know, because Tad surrounded with a lot of military people in his life, certain reports needed to be filed. Nobody can find those reports. They're gone. Anything we do get is so redacted. We have asked for unredacted reports. No. And then, 2 weeks before he died, he was home doing what he loved, fly fishing. His brother flew in from California to go fly fishing with Tad and the other fly fishing team. Tad had a computer, which he bought. It was his. Yes, he used it for military work. A camera that he bought. Yes, he used for military. And a cell phone, all purchased by himself. When we got the computer back, his last fly fishing trip of his life was erased from his computer. His videos, matter of fact, his whole fly fishing career was erased from that computer. The Army did not buy that computer. That was his. They went through. I had my income taxes on there because we shared TurboTax. They erased my tax history. They erased all of his fly fishing pictures from his camera. They erased the emails from home. Anything personal. It was just totally blank. Why give us months and months and months of hope that we are going to get this stuff back? Hopefully, to have some insight and memory of him. Instead, they just wipe the hard drive clear. Gone. To this day, we still do not have the reports. We still, well, we'll never get back everything that they destroyed and wipe out. And we'll never know what truly transpired in that meeting with his higher-ups that resulted in a reprimand. But the only thing the National Guard did admit is they believe that part of the reason he committed suicide was in anguish over the reprimand he received from his higher-ups. But since everything's redacted, we really don't know who was part of all those meetings and what exactly was said. And here we are 2 years later, and we don't have the answers. And the funny thing is, well, no, it's not even funny. It's really sad that the military closed their case on Major Tad Hervis and released it to the public that he had committed suicide the day we buried his dad. It's not enough we have to deal with everything else, but then they throw that on us on that day? That was more than his mother could bear. You know, I know Major Hervis put the gun to his head and pulled the trigger, but his family and I and others believe that the military put it there in the way they handled the situation over in Iraq and the way they continued to handle the situation upon his death. It is like pulling teeth to get anything out of the National Guard. All I have to say is that I have no idea if they knew he was distraught when he left. Somebody didn't escort him back and remove him from his military-issued handgun. And he was left alone. And I just find it very sad that Major Hervis died in this manner, and it could have been totally prevented. But the biggest thing is the way they handled the families. It's like suicide is a secret. It's a shame. And the National Guard was going to do everything they could to keep that a secret. But because he was an officer, highly ranked, well-loved by his men and women, it really, really shook the National Guard. And I feel that they have done everything they can to cover this up because for some reason, this suicide is a black eye on them. And they do not want to address it.
Ms. Martin, thank you for your testimony. Members, are there any questions that you have for Ms. Martin at this point? Thank you for your testimony. You. Appreciate your coming and our condolences to you and your family and to the Hervis family. Remember, this is we're way overdue as far as our dealing with the suicide issue. This will not go away. This will be an ongoing thing that we will be, as a Veterans Committee, both the House and Senate and nationally, will be dealing with this, and as members of the military are dealing with members who are going to be coming back. This will be, as someone mentioned, a tsunami of sorts of dealing with people who are having situations that could lead to this. And we want to be staying on top of this. We want to be appraised of this. So we hope that we will be contacted and we will not let this die. But at this time, we need to move on to talk about the special audit of the Minneapolis Veterans Home. So I'll ask the legislative auditor, Mr. James Noble, to come forward and identify himself and present his report.
Mr. Chair.
Mr. Nobles, please state your name and you may proceed, sir.
My name is Jim Nobles. I'm the legislative auditor. And, Mr. Chair, I did bring copies of the report. I wasn't sure if they had been made available to you already, but we have copies and also this document. Well, Mr. Chair and members of the Joint Committee, it's a challenge after what you've heard to shift gears pretty dramatically, but we've been asked to present to you the findings of a special review we recently released on the Minnesota Veterans Home in Minneapolis. And unfortunately, it also is not good news. Let me give you just a little bit of context very briefly as to why and how we come to conduct these kinds of special reviews. We call them special because they're not scheduled. The Office of the Legislative Auditor mostly does work that we're required to do under the law. For example, right now we are conducting an audit of the state's financial statements. We also have a responsibility to conduct periodic control and compliance audits at around 180 different organizations that are created by the state and receive money from the state. So typically, all of our staff are fully occupied doing those audits. But we also receive from time to time allegations and concerns from citizens, from public officials, sometimes from legislators, about evidence of possible misuse of public funds or other wrongdoing that we need to respond to. And we did, back in July, receive indications from officials at the Minneapolis Veterans Home and from the Department of Veterans Affairs that they were concerned about some financial accounts at the home. We responded to that immediately because we, too, over the years, have had a great deal of concerns about the financial management of the Minneapolis home. We have conducted a number of financial audits there, and I gave you a list of the audit reports that we've issued over the last several years concerning all of the veterans' homes as well as the Department of Veterans Affairs. And as you will see, there are a number of audits that we have conducted at the Minneapolis Veterans Home. And in recent audits, we have pointed to a pattern of financial difficulties there. And each time we have issued one of these reports, we have been told by officials at the Department of Veterans Affairs and at the Minneapolis Veterans Home that the problems will be fixed. But when we go back, we find that many problems continue. And so it was then in that context that we felt we needed to go to the Minneapolis Veterans Home and take a look at the concerns that have been brought to our attention. Ms. Ferkel, Cecile Ferkel, is the Deputy Legislative Auditor for the Financial Audit Division, and she's going to briefly go through that report with you. We also have other representatives of the team that we sent over to the Minneapolis home available to answer questions. So, Mr. Chair, unless there are other questions of me, I'd like to turn to Ms. Ferkel for a brief presentation of our review.
Thank you, Mr. Nobles. So, Ms. Ferkel, for the tape, would you identify yourself? Thank you.
I'm Cecile Ferkel, Deputy Legislative Auditor for the Financial Audit Division. In early July 2011, we were contacted by management at the Minneapolis Veterans Home that some family members of residents had contacted them about some discrepancies in their residents' financial records. The home had taken an initial look at it and thought that things didn't quite look right, and they asked us to come in and do a review, which we did. We actually started that review the next day. Our review involved looking at 18 months of financial activity for the residents' accounts. We went from January 2010 through June 2011, and we did find evidence of financial wrongdoing through our review, and we also identified some weaknesses and controls at the home, and that's what's in the report. We have two findings. The first finding is about the evidence of financial wrongdoing. There were two types of things that we found. One situation was we found about instances where there was a receipt provided by the home's cashier to the resident, a documented receipt, but we don't see that money appearing in the bank deposit, and we don't see that money being credited to the resident's account. There was about $1,600 that we identified during that time frame that we were reviewing, and it affected about 20 residents. We also found the other situation where there was a receipt provided. We didn't see the deposit or the record on that day, but anywhere from a few days later to several weeks later, I think the biggest gap in time we saw was about 6 weeks. At some later point in time, a deposit shows up and a recording in a resident's account shows up that matches the amount of the previously undeposited money. It's a deposit delay that perhaps would most people just seem like a oversight or a correction of an error, but we saw such a pattern of this that we thought that it may be an indication of a type of fraud scheme called skimming, where someone uses receipts and then at a later date substitutes that money with other people's receipts. So we did see also that pattern of the delayed deposits. We saw missing deposits or delayed deposits ranging from $25 to $3,600 and totaling about $16,500. So those were the two pieces we saw, about $6,800 of receipts that never got in the bank, and then about $16,500 where deposit delays were recurring over several days or weeks. We did find that during a period of time when the regular cashier at the home was on a medical leave, they substituted with another personnel, there were no similar types of discrepancies during that time period. Our second finding has to do with weaknesses in the home's internal controls that may have created an environment where these discrepancies could occur without detection. The first weakness we saw was that the cashier was not routinely giving every resident that came to the cashier's window a receipt. And even though the home had policies that required that a receipt always be given for money that was deposited at the home, and the policies even said that on various points in time, random auditing should be done to make sure that receipts are being provided and that the amounts are acknowledged. We didn't see any evidence that those random audits were being conducted, and we think that the home was actually unaware that receipts were not being provided to people that came to the window bringing money for deposits. So that was one weakness. The other one was that the home was doing reconciliations, but they weren't reconciling all the way back to the receipt book. So they would reconcile from the deposit to the resident's account, and they said, well, everything that got deposited got recorded. What they weren't realizing was that not everything was getting initially recorded in the home's records to begin with. So we think that those two weaknesses in the controls created an environment where the discrepancies, whether it's the money that was accepted by the home and not deposited or money that was deposited at some later date, were not identified. The home did provide a response to our recommendations. We can answer questions about the situation. I believe that there are representatives from the home here to speak to the issues also.
Mr. Chairman, if I might just add to what Ms. Ferkel said, we did...
To speak to the issues also.
Mr. Chairman, if I might just add to what Ms. Ferkel said... We did have the individual who we had some concerns about, who was the cashier at some of the times when we saw the difficulties that Ms. Ferkel referred to. We brought that person in and took a statement on, under oath. He did not acknowledge any wrongdoing. However, we have referred this report to the Hennepin County Attorney and to the Minnesota Attorney General. That's something that we are actually required to do under law. It will be up to both the Attorney General to potentially seek civil recovery, and it will be up to Hennepin County Attorney to determine whether or not there is adequate evidence here to bring a criminal charge.
Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Nobles and Ms. Ferkel. We have some questions here. Senator Wieger.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Nobles, have you had any preliminary feedback from the county attorney or AG?
Yes, Mr. Nobles. Mr. Chairman, Senator, we have. I talked to county attorney about the report. We often refer reports to both the Ramsey County Attorney and the Hennepin County Attorney. Again, as I said, under law, they are typically the recipients if there is the potential for a criminal charge, and the Attorney General has a responsibility to potentially seek civil recovery. As I said, we don't have an acknowledgement of wrongdoing by anyone, but we certainly have circumstantial evidence that they will have to examine. It will be their judgment as to how to proceed.
Any other questions? Representative O'Driscoll.
Because it appears that it's an ongoing criminal investigation on here, I'm going to be very, very succinct with my questions on this, and it goes back to more the nature of the funds. Were they in cash form? Were they in cashier's checks? Were they personal checks written from family members of those residing at the home? Maybe get a little more background on the nature of the funds.
Mr. Nobles or Ms. Ferkel?
Mr. Chair and Representative, what we saw seemed to be primarily cash that was brought to the cashier's window.
Representative O'Driscoll.
No further questions.
Any further questions for the testifiers here? If not, we'll move on to some other testifiers. Ms. Pam Barrows, the Interim Deputy Commissioner of Veterans Health, Minnesota Department of VA. Ms. Barrows, if you could identify yourself for the tape, that would be fantastic. Thank you for coming.
Pam Barrows, Interim Deputy Commissioner, Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs.
Thank you. Please proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, Mr. Chair and committee members. I've been the Interim Deputy Commissioner for just a couple of months now. I'm a registered nurse, a Vietnam veteran. I've been working with the vets' homes in one capacity or another since 1987. I was the administrator of the Laverne Vets Home for 14 years, and then moved up to the cities as a senior director for Veterans Health, working with Mr. Acevedo for 3 years. Retired in April and came back in October, mid-October, filling in while we recruit for a permanent replacement for the deputy commissioner. And I would like to introduce our internal auditor, Dave Selko. He'll have an opportunity to give you some detailed progress that the home has made and continues to make related to this and to the past OLA audits. We appreciate your convening this joint committee and for providing an opportunity for us to give you an update on the progress and improved operations at the Minnesota Veterans Home in Minneapolis. Specifically, I want to address the positive changes that have occurred at the Minneapolis home, but I need to probably give you a little bit of the historical context because some of you may know and some of you may not. The Minneapolis Veterans Home started experiencing challenges related to resident care and related issues in about mid-2005. Subsequently, there were a series of leadership changes at the top administrator level and down. And they finally transferred oversight of the homes from the Veterans Home Board to the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs in November of 2007 by executive order. At the same time, the governor appointed a Veterans Health Care Advisory Council as part of that merger. And this group of industry experts continues to meet and has been instrumental in providing feedback and expertise to us and to the homes during the last 4 years. Also, as part of that merger, in January of 2008, the Veterans Health Care Division was created and to manage the 5 state veterans homes, and Deputy Commissioner Gil Acevedo was appointed to oversee that division. Initially, as we started in 2008, the priority was the life safety and the quality of care issues at the Minneapolis home, and that focus has paid off. I'm proud to report that both the Minnesota Department of Health, the VA surveys that we've had have been shown much improvement in the care of that's provided at Minneapolis. In fact, they typically come back higher than the industry standard. We also had a CRIPA, the Department of Justice CRIPA investigation, and they were complimentary of the home's care also. Additionally, all 5 of our state veterans homes have achieved national best-in-class honors from the Pinnacle Satisfaction Surveys during 2011. And these are the folks that We surveyed the families of our veterans and some of our veterans. However, our responsibility goes beyond health and life safety for our resident. It also includes accurately and timely accounting of trust funds and properly managing our home finances. Moving to the current issue, as was stated on July 5th of this year, a family member of a resident came forward with a concern of a cash deposit that didn't appear in his posted account. The home immediately took internal action to review, and the next day they contacted the OLA requesting an external third-party investigation into this issue. We're not able to cover the details of what their internal action involved because of the ongoing investigation and data privacy issues, but we took immediate steps to ensure the suspected activity was addressed, and that we have also taken additional measures to ensure it's not happening now. We deeply regret the recent occurrence at the home, but I would like to take the next few minutes to help you understand the focus we have put into developing a systematic and permanent change of the problems and challenges that we're in a long time making. It's really because of the hard work and dedication of our staff that these changes were possible and that we were able to respond appropriately when the recent cash issue arose. In November of 2008, and Mr. Nobles, I think, passed out or distributed some of the surveys from the Minneapolis home, the Office of Legislative Auditors completed an audit and reviewed the operations of the home from fiscal years 2004 to 2007. There were a total of 18 findings, six of which were unresolved from a previous audit. At that time, the business office was overseen by our previous business office manager, who is no longer with the Veterans Home. In 2010, the OLA came again and conducted another audit for fiscal years 2007 through 2010. We received that report in October of 2010. And during this audit, it was noted that the home had made significant progress to resolve the prior audit findings from the 2008 report. It had fully resolved seven and partially resolved eight. But there were still issues that we had to address. Our current business office manager started actually the day that they started that last audit. And she was permanently in place as our business office manager for Minneapolis in November of 2010. And she's done an excellent job of implementing improvement and changes within that department. However, due to the fact that the vets' homes are required to follow VA as well as federal and state regulations, it can be a difficult and complicated task to learn these systems, and she needed to spend significant time learning the job responsibilities without position overlap. In addition, OLA, as I mentioned, had started on her first day at the home. As a result, she was not only learning a new position, she was also putting systems in place to correct deficiencies cited in the previous audit. In December of 2010, we hired a new administrator who also had to learn the very complicated VA regulatory system as well as the state budgeting system and the detailed performance accountability system in place in the public sector. During that time, the administrator worked daily with the business office to correct deficiencies and improve systems. One of the areas of weaknesses the staff identified early on included concerns with the manual accounting system within the cashier's office. The agency was in the process of developing an RFP that would provide both an electronic medical record system, a financial system, and electronic cashiering system. This the RFP took well over a year because we needed the input from all of the homes, the business managers, the clinical people, et cetera, to make sure that we were going to get what we wanted and what we needed to for all of the homes. So, as a matter of fact, we just signed the RFP, signed the contract this last week, and we're ready to roll out the new system. I would like to turn our attention to the two handouts, the OLA Audit 1033 Corrective Action Plan and the Minneapolis OLA Audit Findings and Corrective Action Summaries. Our internal auditor, Dave Salko, will walk you through these findings and address some of those changes.
Thank you. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair.
If you could identify yourself for the tape, I appreciate it. Thank you.
My name is Dave Salcho, S-A-L-C-H-O-W, and I am the MDVA internal auditor. I'd like to first call your attention to the rather large document, which is the Minneapolis Corrective Action Plan. I wouldn't recommend reviewing it in detail. If you care to, it is all there. I would like to highlight that a lot of progress has been made over the 14 months since the OLA has issued its report. You'll find that 9 of the 13 findings have been resolved, and the other 4 are in the process of being resolved. What I'd like to state here is that we take these findings very seriously, and we constantly are reviewing our status to implement those recommendations and to make improvements to the home. The shorter of the two documents is a listing of just the findings that relate to the cashier's office over the last 2 audits. That would be 2008 and 2010. And simply, I'd like to highlight that all of these findings have been resolved. Together, we believe that these 2 documents demonstrate the improvements to the controls and that those improvements actually allowed the home to detect this issue and report it to the Office of the Legislative Auditor. We're very appreciative of the recommendations that were made in the OLA's reports, and we've implemented those recommendations, and that led us or helped us to discover that we had a problem within the home. Lastly, I'd like to tell you about some of the changes we've made to the home and improvements to the controls that we've made since this issue was discovered in July of 2011. The home implemented a new computerized ledger system with controls that include individual logons, passwords, and an audit trail. Money paid to the home or provided to the home for a deposit for a veteran are entered into the ledger system immediately, and a receipt is created in duplicate. The ledger system allows us to provide detailed account statements monthly to the residents or upon demand. Signage outside the cashier's window informs payers that they should receive receipts. This puts the cashier on notice that they need to input all of the payments received and generate a receipt. That was the issue that occurred. We had an employee who was not entering the money into the books. He was not writing receipts, and when he did write a receipt, he was not always putting that receipt into our books. At the end of each day, this ledger system generates reports, and we have 2 employees who balance the cash. And finally, we have revised policies and procedures have been developed, and we're in the process of implementing those now. Thank you, Pam.
Thank you, Dave. In this case, the system worked because we had the right people and the right processes in place. And in fact, it's the processes the home already had in place that helped identify and confirm the suspected issue of mishandling of cash payments as soon as the concern was brought forward, allowing us to take immediate action and to contact OLA so they could launch a third-party investigation. I can tell you that I'm very, very confident that all of our homes, but particularly Minneapolis, is moving in the right direction, and that if they went in and did a current audit, they'd see a vast improvement, and it'd be closely aligned with the results that we're seeing in related to care. Finally, I'd like to recognize the hard work and dedication by our staff at the Minneapolis Veterans Home. Their commitment to the residents at this facility is not only noticeable, it's so much appreciated. And we get that as soon as this came to light, or when the Office of Legislative Auditors made public their findings. We couldn't really do anything prior to that time. We sent out letters to all of the families, to the residents. The administrator of the Veterans Home attended the family council, and there were 50 residents there. Talked to them about the issue. We've notified all of our stakeholders, and since it's become public, the Minneapolis home has had 2 people come and want follow-up on something, and one wasn't even related to the issue. It was just how much money he had in his account. The folks, the residents, and the families truly appreciate what Minneapolis does, and they truly appreciate the fact that when something does happen, we identify it. We're trying to be very, very transparent and put things in place that to continuously improve. And that's kind of the bottom line. So thank you for your time. And at this point, if you have any specific questions, we would try and answer them for you.
Thank you, Ms. Barrows. Thank you, Mr. Selko. Members, do we have questions? Representative Detmer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And probably for Mr. Selko, is it most of the fraud was dealing with cash deposits or anything with checks?
Mr. Chairman, Representative, it's my understanding that it was all cash receipts.
Okay.
Nothing to do with checks or wired money, simply cash.
Okay. Mr. Detmer, just a follow. Would it make any sense to go away from cash deposits? If that's something to be done, you know, would it be possible to do that?
Mr. Selko?
Mr. Chair, Representative, that's a great question. We actually asked ourselves that internally. Unfortunately, if you pull a bill out of your pocket, it does say legal tender.
Yeah.
You do have to accept it. And it was as a result of all of this, it was surprising to us how many families that we deal with that are unbanked, if you will actually come up to the window and make cash payments. The management team was of the idea that this was a very small occurrence, and it was a surprise to us. There actually were three families that would predominantly come and make relatively significant cash payments on their accounts, ranging from $1,300 to all the way up to $3,000. You can't say no to cash.
Yeah. Thank you.
Thank you. Any other questions for the testifiers? Thank you very much for coming forward, and we'll be in touch.
Thank you.
Next, our testifying list is the Commissioner of the Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs, Larry Shelton. Welcome back.
Chair, committee members, I'm Commissioner Larry Shalito, and this is my prepared remarks. You have heard from Deputy Commissioner Reggie World and Deputy Commissioner Pam Barrows that we have a lot happening in the state in regards to ensuring that we provide necessary services as they are needed and projected to be needed for our current and future generations of veterans. You're all aware that my responsibility is ensuring that the needs of the state's 381,301 veterans are both identified and executed. You're equally aware that the breadth and depth of those needs are great and continue to evolve. I stated more than once, metaphorically, that the war is the earthquake and the tsunami is and will continue to be the returning veterans. For over 10 years now, we have been at war, and although we have witnessed the last of our fighting forces depart Iraq yesterday, we will continue to rotate troops through Afghanistan. Veterans are still being generated every day. You heard earlier from Major General Nash when he stated that soldiers, part of their ethos is never leave a fallen comrade on the battlefield. I am here to remind you that ethos doesn't simply fade away when you take off the uniform, as was so eloquently demonstrated by Greg, and that I am committed to ensuring that our veterans receive every bit of support that they need to successfully reintegrate back into civil society, and that can be a timely and an intensive process. Whether these needs are in the area of health care, education, counseling, employment, or any other area, to include suicide prevention or internal business practices that we have discussed today, I'm committed to creating an organizational culture and preparing the foresight to lead Minnesota Department of Veterans Affairs into the future to ensure that all the needs are identified, actionable measures are taken to resolve them, and positive results occur. Our veterans have done everything we have asked. Now it's our time to both continue success we have achieved and continue to be vigilant and shape the future for their success and the success of the state. I realize that the pending question is, what as a legislature can you do to help the veterans and ensure the department's success in this mission? The answer is simple. Continue to support us in our mission. Support comes in many forms. Although our budget is vital to services we provide, and although we are very fortunate to maintain current funding levels, realize that now and in the next few years to come, as the tsunami of veterans continue to return and the military downsizes as it always does after war, we ask that as innovative ideas emerge for future success for our veterans, that you are and will remain supportive. There are initiatives that I am certain you will see in the near future that we believe will be beneficial to the veterans' homes, and the operation of the departments that can and will assist in ensuring successful reintegration of Minnesota's sons and daughters. We ask for your support. We also ask that our new veterans continue to return to the state, that we don't forget about the ones that came before them, our past veterans. As you know, we are seeking the expansion of the Minnesota GI Bill for all eras of veterans so that they can ascertain assistance as they may require that may be required for employment or to stay competitive. I ask for your support in getting that proactive legislation passed. It is also one of our initiatives to see that it is our veterans receive proper honors at their burials. This is a relatively low-cost initiative and in many cases is the only benefit many of our veterans desire. I ask for your support and commitment ensuring that that initiative is successful. Although there will certainly be more, these are just a few examples of things that I will mention today that I believe will assist our sons and daughters in Minnesota, both old and young, as we continue to look ahead, and I encourage you to continue to communicate and work with us to ensure the stage is set for the needs of our veterans. Earlier I mentioned that simply because you remove the uniform, the traits, ethos, values that are instilled in our great military members simply does not fade away. It stays with you. It shapes your character and the way one strives to achieve results in whatever it is they are doing. One of the values instilled as a soldier is to leave the place better than when you got there. And that is exactly what I intend to do. And so I ask that you assist me in doing so. The mantra that I will be using is, we are committed to bringing our veterans all the way home. Subject to your questions.
Thank you.
Commissioner,
any questions for the commissioner at this point? I have one question. This is a kind of a new job that you've taken on with the position of commissioner over there. Being in the military, and myself included, some of us here, we sometimes get spot inspections unbeknownst to us that we show up and all of a sudden the hair's out of place. We got something missing. I'm thinking, I'm just wondering what you're going to do at the sort of Minneapolis Veterans Home as far as picking up. Is there any type of spot inspections that you will do or your people will do to curtail what's happened here with the receipts that are missing? And we know we're seeing a discrepancy between what was supposedly in a book that didn't get shown, and I'm just wondering what your positive response to that situation is going to be.
Mr. Chair, thank you. That's an interesting question. I've been involved over the years, whether it be in education or military, so forth. What I have found in the homes in particular, and there's two cultures. The homes outstate have a culture of that community unto himself. Once you get into Hastings and Minneapolis, the metro has a different culture. First of all, I found all five homes to be outstanding. I have found the people to just want to be recognized and appreciated for the work that they do. Is there tweaking? Yes. But the state has a number of systems in place that we are capitalizing on. I'm more concerned not so much what I'm going to inspect, but what can we develop and create that will live on well beyond me being gone. What is the culture? That is absolutely critical. First of all, I'm very, very proud and pleased of these homes. You know, I was two floors up when all this turbulence was going on about the homes from before. And I have not found that. Gil Acevedo, the predecessor who came through, did a lot of things to create a command culture, command climate, if you will, that says things are improving. We have hired a number of young administrators, young being relative to me. They are eager to learn. They are aggressive. They are caring. Absolutely phenomenal. In fact, that's going to be probably one of the most critical processes that we look at in the new hire. I'm scared about the new hire. Because first of all, they have to be a veteran, which automatically narrows it down to 1.5% of the total population. We're going to do that, and then we're going to, even though we're handicapped, you know, with salary caps and all those other types of things. But we're going to take a look at how they care and how they interact with the residents first, and the staff and the whole community to make those things happen. So we're gradually moving forward. It's and then internally, I mean, I grew up when it was quality circles. Then it became Deming, you know, and then it became, now it's Lean this, and then it's Lean Six Sigma, then it's the Japanese terms of Kaizen. We're doing all that stuff. And so what I'm doing, Robin is sitting over here, she's got kind of the lead on that, she's got the background on that. What we're trying to do is build from within. Will I do the inspections? That is correct. But my inspections will be, as I walk through the halls, the smiles on their face, their willingness to talk to me, how they say hi or avoid, all of those types of things are going into place. Am I going to sit down and open up the checkbook, and I'm an old accounting graduate, and do line item by line item? No, I don't believe in that. But I am going to make sure that we have the systems and the processes in place. So we're building a team. I would dare say in a couple of years when we come back, Chair Anderson, you'd be saying, wow, things have been happening and things are good. If not, then you can chew me out as much as you want, and I'll take it. But we're onto something good here. And I'm not afraid to call the Office of Legislative Auditors or my staff. They did that. They didn't ask for permission. They said something's wrong, and the first question they know I would ask them is, what are you doing about it? And then Shelley did something about it. She did it right. We brought them in. We find it out, and we're getting those answers. And then Pam just briefed you on the fact, and Dave also, that now we have a process in place. We're doing a detailed analysis, and this is staff ownership. I didn't write this. They did. And it's not a gotcha. It's something that they have designed that they want to get going. So there's new homes in the state of Minnesota, and they're even going to get better. That's probably not the answer you were looking for, but I'm not a micromanager. So, thank you.
Thank you. Representative Detmer?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. This is just a comment, and, you know, I personally believe we have the right person in the right place at the right time as commissioner with Commissioner Shelletob. But as a committee, if you are serving on the Veterans Committee and you haven't visited a veteran's home, you should do that. I had an opportunity to visit the one in up north, northern Minnesota, in Silver Bay. We have a little house up there, and I just called them up out of the blue and asked to come in for a tour, and it was just great. They're, at that time, they're doing new construction and so forth, and it was great to go through and talk to some of the veterans and also the people that work there. So I would encourage people on the committee to get out and see the veterans' homes and let them know ahead of time that you'd like to come in for a tour, and it's great. We should all do that.
I would echo that. That is good. I've been on several tours of the Minneapolis Vets Home and others, and it's a good place to be and to see the work that you do and your people behind it. It's just concerning to us, I guess, that, you know, this has to get out, and we all want to be able to stop any type of indiscretion that is going on and make sure that we change it and turn it around. And I think that maybe we as a committee would probably be looking in the next 6 months or so or less of some kind of a report back from either the OLA or yourself, yeah, as to some of the positive things that are going on to show that this is, you're going after the
the situation and trying to remedy it. So, Representative O'Driscoll.
I keep wanting to call you General Shalito. Commissioner Shalito, you, when you were the Adjutant General, set the bar very high for success and demanded an awful lot from the people that reported to you. And that's, again, through your work with the Beyond the Yellow Ribbon community, which you alluded to in your earlier testimony. You have set the bar very high for yourself. And when you say that you're going to be stepping out and working to prevent these things in the future, I fully believe that's the case, because you have set that bar high for yourself and that you do want to succeed. And so I will echo Representative Detmer's comments that we do, I believe, have the right man at the right time for the right job. So thank you so much.
Mr. Chair, Representative Driscoll, thank you. These comments are very nice. But, Chair Anderson, I will be visiting with you one-on-one. And there's a number of things that I have seen that are not formulated totally yet that I need some guidance on that can eliminate barriers and booby traps, if you will, using the military analogies, that we can move forward, that is language, something that can be changed, that will enable us to be far more effective, efficient, and proactive or reactive. I don't want to hear about an RFP going another year, those types of things. But that'll happen because it's money involved. But there's a number of personnel things and so forth that will need teamwork.
Thank you for your testimony. Appreciate your coming today, and we'll be in touch. Anybody in the audience that would like to speak on behalf of the issue of the Minneapolis Veterans Home? Would you come forward and give your name and address your concern?
My name is Charlie McAdon. I'm a disabled veteran, veterans advocate, former commander of Disabled American Veterans Chapter in St. Paul. I have a radio show in central Minnesota for veterans the middle of each month, and I had the honor to have Commissioner Shalito on my show last week, a week and a half ago, as a guest speaker. And Mr. Shalito has it under control, let me tell you. This man is on top of things. As for the veterans' home, we talked a little bit about that. I wasn't going to bring it up because the issue had only broke the day before, and I didn't know if he wanted to talk about it, but he brought it up. So we discussed it a little bit. And I said, well, is the guy still there? The employee still there? I said, has he been fired? Well, we're working on that. This is what you mean. We ran into a problem. And hand take care of that. I said, what's that? The union. Just now, we heard Mr. Shalito ask to eliminate barriers. This is a barrier. In Minnesota, we have a situation where we have critical needs departments throughout the state. I believe, I don't know the exact extent of it, but I believe there's a rule here a while back or a law, you know, came up that said on these critical needs things, for an example, snow plowing, unions can't interfere with the operation of the state. There are certain departments throughout the state. We're talking about human lives here. We're talking about veterans' lives here. Why are unions interfering? Why are they not part of this critical needs thing? Okay, I'm just bringing this out to you. Perhaps this committee would like to look into that or help with that. That would definitely be a, you know, if one of your employees stepped out of line, spent money that he wasn't supposed to, and you fired him. You know, we have an attorney general on staff that gets paid, whether she's here or not, to defend against this kind of stuff, to defend the Veterans Department. Okay, I'll let that go at that. A year ago, we were talking about removing certain people, deputy chairs of different departments, deputy commissioners, I believe it was, eliminating it down to one, except Department of Veterans Affairs. They wanted to keep, Governor Polanyi hired a gentleman special, brought him in from California to manage the veterans' homes for the state. In addition to the five managers, I believe there's six, there might be two over at Minneapolis. In addition to those, this man just left, resigned this summer and left. 1st of November, 1st of October, something like that. His sole job was to manage the veterans' homes. This stuff keeps popping up and popping up and popping up. Well, why do we have a legislative audit like this, a negative audit like this, when we have someone, in addition to the directors of the homes and their staff, we have someone senior to them, and we still can't catch this stuff? I'll tell you what, talk to Mr. Schellero. He's on top of it. He's working on it, and he's doing a darn good job. But he's only one man. And I believe his hands are tied with things like you said, there are barriers. A few minutes ago, we heard that we've heard budget constraints throughout our conversations today. I don't know if this panel is aware of it. Mr. Chair, I'm sorry I failed to address you earlier. But Minnesota receives 72 cents on the dollar return on their tax dollar for veterans. 72 cents on a dollar. Earlier we heard that Minnesota's a national leader in veterans things for 72 cents on a dollar. South Dakota, right next door, they receive, I believe, quote me if I'm wrong, around $1.37, something like that, on the dollar. This, we should have some of our federal legislators sitting here today. A lot of this stuff here today should be addressed by the federal government level. Our senators, our representatives on the federal level. This panel can only do so much when their hands are tied. Like the lady testified earlier, she can't get things from the federal government. Our federal senators should be stepping in here, our federal representatives. Like I said, 72 cents on a dollar, and we're the number one in the nation. When South Dakota is receiving $1.30 something, pardon me, for Mr. Sheldon. But anyway, we discussed this in fact. Mr. Sheldon's on top of this stuff. He knows what's going on, and he is doing one heck of a job without the constraints that he has.
Mr. Mayor,
turn this man loose, I'll tell you what. Give him what he needs.
Right.
We won't be here today.
Thank you.
Let me check my little notes here. I believe we need to put the veterans' homes on this list of critical departments and release them from the constraints of unions. There's something to think of. I thank you all very much. I appreciate your time.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. McAdam. Any questions for Mr. McAdam? Members, thank you for the testifying today. Thank you to the legislative auditor and his staff coming forward today. Appreciate that. Members, you have in your packets a blue expense sheet that needs to be filled out if you want to be reimbursed for your expenses. I need to sign those in order for my legislative assistant to get them in process. Any other questions for the good of the order at this time? I wish you all a Merry Christmas, and we'll be in touch. Meeting's adjourned.